Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And don't take our late attendance for any disinterest in your topic. It's there's lunch going on, and so we're already fascinated with what you're going to see.
Understood, Mr. Chair. My name is Jane Rankin. I am the budget director at the Department of Human Services, and I have two budget change pages to review with you today. The first one is on page 18 of your budget book. It is our recommendation for a general administrative reduction agency-wide. This budget recommendation is for $12 million in a permanent reduction to administrative operations in the agency. And I do want to point out to you and the members that this is, as I said initially, it's agency-wide, which means because of the way we had to put this information into the budget system, it has been allocated proportionally across state operated services, central office, and the MSOP program. However, that does not mean that you should assume that the number allocations that you see on the fiscal pages are the way that the agency would plan to administer this reduction. At this point,
it's a placeholder, you mean?
It is essentially a placeholder. We know that we will be reducing a net general fund amount of $12 million in the biennium, but we don't have a plan in place yet for how we will do that. That's going to depend, honestly, on what happens with other budget proposals.
And do you think that, have you taken into consideration some things that might happen, finding fraud and so on, that you wouldn't have found that's going to actually increase the forecast? Have you taken that into consideration at all? Or do you plan to at some point?
Mr. Chair, I'm not quite understanding the connection. You will see, when you see on particular budget pages references to FTE changes up and down, that is because essentially, remember that a budget page is essentially a mini fiscal note. And so it is intended to fully represent the cost of the proposal to the agency, both in terms of expenses, our savings in most of the cases this year, but also in terms of impact on FTEs. So that does not necessarily connect to what we would do with this administrative reduction or other enacted budget proposals.
Well, what I was getting at is just a non-dynamic fiscal notes that are there. Like if you cut our anti-fraud position, you would have lost some of the people that were, so you would have found there were fraudulent, and there would have actually been fraud you wouldn't have found, so it would have actually cost the state money. If you had a helpline for Minnesota Care that has less people, those people might get on Minnesota Care, and you'd save more money. So. When you do those kinds of position cuts, do you think about that?
I understand your question, Mr. Chair. I apologize for not tracking at first. What you are referring to is kind of the art part of creating the fiscal notes, which is that we do try to capture the primary impact, fiscal impact of whatever the change is on the page. But there are secondary impacts to some of the proposals, and it is a kind of a question of we go back and we look at what our history has been in past fiscal notes and how we've thought about constructing our analysis. And there is at some point, honestly, a line that we draw and say, okay, this is the universe of costs that we're going to consider for a given fiscal note.
Sure. And when the time comes, if we need some help with that art, kind of prove our point, that we'll be hoping that we can get the benefits of that too sometime. So, any questions about this piece? I think you've convinced us. Thank you. You can move to the next one.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The other page that I am presenting is the other one that has agency-wide impact, and that is page 23, which is merging the Health Care Access Fund into the general fund. And I know that this committee has already had discussions about this at other hearings, so I don't know to what extent you want me to go into the detail on this, but essentially the proposal recognizes that the people who are served through programs funded by the Healthcare Access Fund, that there's a lot of similarity and overlap in the kinds of programs that are funded through that this particular accounting fund as compared to the other healthcare programs that we fund through the general fund. And there is an additional level of complexity on the administrative side, having two separate funds. There's some accounting complexities that make it additional work for state agency staff, both at DHS and also at MMB on the accounting side. So with a recognition of the other reductions in the healthcare programs in this budget, this proposal would merge the Healthcare Access Fund into the general fund. So then the tax revenues that now go into the Healthcare Access Fund would on July 1st instead go into the general fund.
I just have one question, maybe members may have some more. Just on the technical side, is there any savings in not having a Healthcare Access Fund compared to having keeping it? Is there like bookkeeping costs or one FTE to track separate numbers, or is it just totally a wash, however way it's tracked administratively?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't think that we quantified the impact at our agency and at MMB, which is the other agency that I can think of that would be most affected by merging the two funds.
Okay, that's fine.
So that's probably not, that's one of the reasons for doing this page, but not the only reason for doing the page.
Thanks for that helpful answer. Oh, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. If the legislature chose not to do some of the eligibility changes that are proposed in the budget, but did do some of the merging that is considered, do you know what impact that would have on the Healthcare Access Fund in the upcoming biennium and maybe the biennium after that, please?
Ms. Rankin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, so your question is if you did only some of the eligibility changes, but not all, and you chose to merge the Healthcare Access Fund into the general fund, the impact is which, what impact are you wondering about?
Ms. Murphy.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You know, it is, I asked that question in such a funny way. So how about this? How about if we didn't change eligibility at all and we didn't do any merging of programs? Do you know what the state or the fund balance would be in the Healthcare Access Fund in the next two biennia?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, and actually I think I saw that you have this information in your green pages, unless I was mistaken. Page 32 in your green pages is the Healthcare Access Fund statement. So it would show you that the projected... So you do not want to do any of the governor's recommendations, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, this is not a question of what I want to do. This is a hypothetical question. But, you know, it would be pretty clear, at least from the district in which I come, that I wouldn't want to do any of those eligibility changes.
Well, that's from Murphy. Are you just asking what current law would give us in health care access fund?
There's another way to do it.
Okay. I think there's a chart. Is there a chart, Ms. Rankin?
Yes, I was just looking at it. It's page 32 in your appendix, although now that I look at it, it does include the governor's recommendations.
Yes.
I think my recollection is, without looking at the governor's budget at all, that by the end of the fiscal 11 the end of the 10-11 biennium, there is a balance of $114 million in the healthcare access fund.
I think that Mr. Wall could get us a copy for that if we wanted to have a copy of the healthcare access. You might have it memorized too. But
That would be the November forecast healthcare access fund statement, and it is on the MMB website. I just don't have that version in my book. I
Mr.
have Wall's one which
the website right now and pull on a copy.
Governor's rest.
Okay. Is that enough? Can I ask more?
Just one follow-up, Mr. Chair. On the website, do we have a projection of the healthcare access fund in the next biennium after?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, the fund balance goes out through the end of fiscal 13, so it's the upcoming 10-11 biennium and the next one as well. And there is a point where it goes negative under current law, and I think you would see that.
I bet that'll be on the chart.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
We're all here to help. Any other questions about the healthcare access fund proposed merger? I think you, is that it? You get to escape now?
That's it, my 2 pages.
Okay. Wait, is there, Representative Root has, she doesn't want you to get off that easy, but Representative Root has a question.
Well, maybe just more a comment, and I'm sure we'll have, thank you, Mr. Chair, I'm sure we'll have further discussion about it. I think there's a perception out there that the healthcare access fund is solely the provider tax, I think. I mean, I could be wrong about that, but I think that's kind of the general perception. And so if there really is, I think the concern, if this happens, is that we were told this morning, I think, Representative Murphy and I, that there's a perception that the people who are paying that look at it as a huge tax increase, basically. It's not how they phrase it. Hold on. So if this really is going to, I just want to make sure, I guess, that it's not going to take away any of the services that for which it was intended. And if this is really just a way to streamline it and we can do it more efficiently, and that's the case that came in. Am I off on this?
Ms. Rankin.
No, Mr. Chair and Representative Rood, this budget proposal does not affect the level of the provider tax or the other tax that goes into the health care access fund currently is the gross premium tax. There's also some federal FFP that's earned, and there's a small amount of premiums that individuals pay. The proposal to merge the fund into the general fund doesn't change any of those things.
Representative Root.
No, that's
okay. I think I'm going to call the meeting to order so we can get our questions on the record. And since Representative Powell had a question, I'll also let him be raising his hand to move the minutes. The motion which is in order, and so we'll now act on that motion.
Do we have a quorum to move the minutes?
We do. We have a quorum. That's why we're in order now. So
move.
Thanks. Any questions about the minutes? And they're really nice minutes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Minutes are adopted. Representative Tao.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm going to take Representative Enzel's path and ask the question directly. With this move, this proposal, is it the department's understanding that the money will be easier to be accessed by other programs if it's in the general fund?
Ms. Rankin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tao, the decision to make appropriations is yours as the legislature. And so how you choose to do that is up to you and not up to this agency.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I understand that part. At the same time, the governor also has latitude in proposing through the department, and so my question is it fair to say yes, this might lead to having all of us the ability to not use the healthcare access fund for health programs?
Well, that's some time. It was comment or thought that I have, and just to the whole point of it here. If you look at the general fund expenditures on health stuff, it's like what is Mr. Wells, like $10 billion a biennium or something. And so the Minnesota Care Fund, or the health care system was Minnesota Care, but it gets broader and broader, and unemployed people, there's a bill coming up about that, and wonderful uses, and we do stuff with that money that is not always as careful as you do with general fund money, because it's there. And that's, as I was reading some of the background, why it's not so bad to do that, because we spend a lot more general funds than just the healthcare access money, which is a sick tax anyway. And it may just be a bookkeeping thing if it doesn't save any money to have the fund or not have the fund, but it gives some symbolism. Ironically, in some of the proposals, the people who pay in can't even serve the people. And there's people in the networks who serve people and some who are out of networks in the same profession who can't serve people, yet they pay the 2%. So I think I'm not helping, but it's just it's not as a pure thing as it could be, and I don't, you know, and even with the projected merging it, the whole budget goes up 10% general fund. And so we have to make some decisions, and maybe our decisions are more free without it. Maybe that's what some of the leadership is up in the town.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I think that's something that we have to, we're thinking, are we ready to move that route? Because all week this week we've been hearing testimonies from health providers, and they're saying we would prefer that the healthcare access fund go towards these programs. And I'm just afraid that if we move in this direction, it'll be symbolism, or it'll be easier for other folks to say, well, it's general fund, so we're going to use it. That's
That's the debate we're going to have, I think. And probably you got the vote, so it might go kind of your way. So. anybody else on this question? Reverend Murphy, did you want to? You're done. I think maybe you can make your escape now. Thank you for coming in. Appreciate
Thank
your cooperation.
You.
Who's coming down next? Mr. Kerber? Always good to have you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the director of the licensing division, and I think Ann Berry is on your schedule, but she was unable to be here. And I'm here to talk about two of the budget pages. The first page is number 21. And this is titled Restructuring Licensing Funding. And just by way of a little background here, the licensing division of the Department of Human Services issues about 25,000 licenses. About 4,000 of those are programs that are monitored directly by the department through a state licensing staff. And about 21,000 are monitored by our county partners out there. We issue licenses, we issue licensing sanctions. But the regular routine monitoring activities are completed by counties. For our funding for our activities, we do background studies, and we do maltreatment investigations, and we do complaint investigations. And the funding for our activities comes from a number of different sources. For our background studies, a lot of it is fee-based, where we charge an actual fee per background study for some types of background studies. For others that we do, for instance, for nursing homes and hospitals, the cost comes out of their licensing fee that's paid to the health department and deposited in the special revenue fund, and then we get some of that money through an interagency agreement. When it comes to our licensing fees, our directly licensed activities, however, we're fairly dependent on the general fund. And what we're looking at in this case is there's a statutory provision in Chapter 16A that says that if a state agency or government agency collects a fee for a licensing activity, it should be about right. It should neither significantly over-recover nor under-recover the cost, unless otherwise specified in the statute. And as we look around, we see that most licensing functions in state government are more consistent with that concept, where the licensing activities that they perform are funded really from the revenue that's collected from the licensing fee. So that's the direction we're trying to move with this proposal over a two-year period. And in order to get there, we need to increase our fees, unfortunately. But the plan here is that we would raise those fees, and then when we're collecting a fee that's about right, to cover our costs, then we'll transfer our funding relationship from the general fund into the state over to the state government special revenue fund, like the other licensing agencies. So it's sort of a 2-year proposal that we've got here. In doing this, I think you know, I mentioned that there is some relief to the general fund here that we're seeking. At issue is about $4.5 million a year, and right now our licensing fees that we collect are about 2.1 only. And so there's some other FFP that we're eligible to receive on that difference between those two. There's $2.4 million that's available, or that's eligible for FFP, federal participation. And so what we're going to do is save the general fund $1.4 million a year with this proposal. So I think if anybody had questions about the specific impact of this fee increase, as we have in our first iterations of it, at any rate, I believe you all got the handout that show the breakdown of fee increases by license type.
Mr. Kerber, maybe you can just save us the visits to our offices. Who's going to come and say that they're going to be put out of business or harmed by this? Is anybody going to say that, or are they going, well, it probably should cost that much?
Well, Mr. Chair, some of the fee increases are more significant than others. And it sort of depends on a number of factors, but a big one is whether or not there is any, whether our activities are subsidized in any way by any other source, like the federal government. So like for chemical dependency treatment program licensure, we receive some federal funding for licensing activities. So chemical dependency treatment program fees are not increasing very much. Similarly, child care centers are going to experience the same thing. So fees are going to go up, but $75 the first year and $70 the first year and $65 the second year. It's not as dramatic as some because, again, we have some federal funding that helps with that cost. Other areas, it's going to hit more significantly. Adult mental health programs, for instance, are going to increase in the end by $4,000 per year. They're currently paying $400 a year. And it's going to go up to $4,400 a year.
So maybe you should talk about that one a little bit.
The
what you found one to bring up, then? Who would that be? Is this the? Tell us what kind of, is that the four-person group homes or is that something else?
Mr. Chair, no. These are the intensive residential treatment facilities for adults with serious and persistent mental illness, and. One of the reasons the costs are so high there are because of there's a much greater time needed these days to do our licensing monitoring of those programs since the redesign of the adult mental health treatment system. Those programs now are eligible for MA reimbursement for their services in part because of the increased standards. And so it takes us more work to do the licensing visits because we're looking for compliance with standards that they need to meet in order to be eligible for the funding. And so our licensure is their ticket to the funding. And so in a program like that, for instance, also they will still have the ability to adjust their rates to take into account this new licensing fee. Now, not everybody will, but those programs would.
So they can actually... Is that 50% match in there? Is that MA paid then?
Mr. Chair, for the services, when they're MA paid, yeah, it's 50% match.
So they could, how do they set their rates? They just make up a price and you pay it, or there must be a schedule you go with, or do we approve it here?
Well, Mr. Chair, for those programs in particular, they have what's referred to as a cost-based rate, and so that gets negotiated, and I believe that one gets negotiated with the department. But so it's based on their actual cost. Now, it's not to say that all programs we license are that way, but those are.
So if they add this cost, if they add the $4,000 or whatever increase to their cost, they'll get $2,000 back. They'll get their rate adjusted and pick up $2,000. So the cost would be $2,000 to them instead of the $4,000, probably, in terms of their net?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that they'll get the $4,000. But when it's paid to them, the funding that they receive will be half federal money and half from either state or county.
I got it. So two of the four, this is your business. Mm-hmm. So two of the 4,000 is going to come from the general fund anyway, as their rates go up. And is there a change page that shows the 2,000 coming out of, is that on the other continuing care part or mental health pages somewhere?
Mr. Chair, I don't think it goes out that far, no.
Is that part of the art that we were talking about?
I think that would be part of the art we heard about.
I think Representative Tom has a question.
Yeah.
No.
No? No, you don't.
All right. And so it really costs that much. So they're not going to come to us either because they don't mind having no change in their net price either, right?
Well, I can't promise that, Mr. Chair.
So they might be coming.
And I'm sure you're going to hear from other providers, too. You know, the providers that of services for people with developmental disabilities. That's an area where we are totally dependent on the general fund for funding of our activities. And so those fees are going to be increasing pretty significantly as well.
What kind of, would that be the four-unit one?
Those would be waiver programs. The four-bed, Mr. Chair, the four-bed programs you're talking about generally are adult foster care licenses, and those licensing fees are not part of this proposal. In fact, this proposal is only related to the fees that are currently collected by the Department of Human Services for our licensing activities. When I talked about our county partnership, those licensing, those license types are adult foster care, child foster care, family adult day services, and in-home adult daycare, and then family child care. The counties have some authority to charge fees for those services. Not all do, and there's some variation, but it's a discretionary fee that they can charge. Where counties have the authority to charge a fee, the state does not. So for adult foster care, for instance, you may hear about increased fees that are being charged for the license, but that's not part of this, and that's not the state. That would be the county charging those fees.
Please help to clarify that a bit. Anybody have a question about this? I think these other representatives might have a question.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kerber, more of a comment is that Mr. Kerber's been before our committee, the Early Childhood Committee, and we have talked through a lot of the changes there, and we had a public hearing and had a number of providers talk about that it was going to be difficult. So I think as members we need to consider that. I also do have a question. If I'm right, I mean, I believe one of my constituents has a child in one of the facilities. Will the cost be passed on to the families in any way? Potentially the licensing, so you say they have to pay more to the Department of Human Services, right? And then there's some insurance provided, obviously it's going to cover the services, but I think the parents are also paying some. Will the cost go up for the parents if they have children in those facilities?
Mr. Chair and Representative Slavik, you know, the cost to pay the licensing fee are going to come from somewhere. I mean, we have to admit that. If it's a children's residential facility, more than half of the kids who are today receiving services in out-of-home placement in residential facilities are paid through private insurance. So those rates get negotiated between the provider and the insurance company, as I understand it. Now, when co-pays are determined and things of that nature with the insurance company, I'm not quite sure how that's going to happen. I think in some settings where parents are paying for some services, certainly child care, it's reasonable to expect that those costs, some of these costs would probably be passed on to the parents.
Right, and that's, Mr. Chair, yeah. And members, I think we need to think about that. I mean, we all know the state's in a difficult budget situation, but if it is potentially going to wind up in the pocketbooks of parents, can parents still continue to have high-quality child care? Will they go to a different place? What will happen? I think we have to think about the consequences. There are consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Well, you raise a good point, Mr. Slavik. And maybe, I don't know, that if there's such an overlap in all the services that you license, but somebody at some point will need to know here which of these, let's say we agree that fees should be paid and cover the cost. That's a fine model. Until some family gets $2,000 added on and they lose the whole services or something. And so as this goes on, if somebody could figure out, I don't know who I'm even asking, but that's a decision, that's the information that we would want to know as the budgets are put, especially the chairs of the entities that are doing that, so you want to know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is
to your point, because this is my first year on the committee, so, you know, I can ask any dumb question and get by with it. I understand that. But as we go through the budget, it appears to me, from someone who's not knowledgeable in this area, is that everything we do causes an effect somewhere else. And so we have no idea if we're in fact cutting the budget or if we're increasing the budget. And so how do we, it's not real clear to me if we're doing this and moving someone somewhere else, and especially in the case where people will then go to hospital emergency rooms, we haven't factored in that cost. So then what is a savings and what is a cost? It seems to me that as we're cutting, we're raising something else, and how can we balance in that fashion? It's not clear to me.
That's our responsibility to figure that out. And welcome to the committee. It's every year, you know, in these little sessions we have, we all learn every day we're here something new. Mr. Kerber learns something every week. Preston Anzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dovetailing off Representative Scalzi's comment, I think this is really creative and a very smart way of readjusting rates to compensate for an increase in the fee for licensure in situations where medical assistance is the funding stream that provides the service or the care. My concern is in settings and services for populations where medical assistance is not the funding stream, we're definitely going to be hearing from providers and parents and population. And there should be no suggestion that that won't happen.
I think that's a good point. It's just help us know what we're doing. And this is just a messenger. I want to remind you, but he's done.
And
there he is. Oh, he made up these ideas.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, I mean, it's really smart on the MA service side. This is really smart. It's on the other side that I get the concern.
I think the compliment part can just go with that, Mr. Kerber. Representative Geffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's an interesting discussion. I think on philosophy-wise, we already have state law that says that if you're going to charge a fee, it should match the cost. And I think it's important that we should have a fee that doesn't undercharge. And it sounds like, and this happens sometimes when times are good, we let those things float a little bit. Times like this point up those situations. So I think it's a sound public policy. It's current state law. We should adhere to it, but if you're going to make a change, make it gradual enough so people can absorb and adjust and not necessarily make it too strong. But I think it is sound public policy, and I think it's something that we should look to do, but also implement if it's gotten really out of whack gradually enough. My question is this gradual enough to accomplish that purpose?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kickmeyer, we're doing it over a two-year period. That's the biennium. There are other options, I guess. What we're looking at is this, you know, this budget cycle. We're increasing it half the first year and then the second half the second year. I'm sure for some that will not look gradual enough, but we're working within this constraint.
I think it's productive. I'm sorry, Representative Gottwell.
We're having a good discussion here. We're going over the licensing thing pretty thoroughly. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. My question to Mr. Kerber and members, this is something else that we're about here too. Is we are facing a big deficit, and yes, there are real human impacts to what we're trying to do here. But we're also trying to do things smarter. And I wonder if you could speak, Mr. Kerber, to whatever your department has done to try to streamline licensing, to make it more efficient, more effective. I hear all the time about there are county people inspecting things, there are state people inspecting things, and there seems to be a sense that we could be doing things like licensing and inspections in a more efficient manner. Maybe you could speak to that.
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gallo, I think we're challenged to do that on a continuous basis. Over the years, we've worked really hard not to have any duplicative licensing efforts with the Department of Health. Several years ago, we had
similar duties and similar facilities, and we really work to streamline that so that it's one agency or the other, and we really kind of accept the other's work as representative of compliance with our licensing standards. And that's most noticeable, I guess, in our ICFMR facilities. And we try to do that with counties all the time, trying to look for more efficiencies. And I think the legislature in 2007, for instance, we had a proposal where we moved some of the background study requirements that counties had related to the, like, child foster care licensing and adoption agencies. We had a proposal to move those to the state, largely in response to some new federal requirements in the Adam Walsh Act. But it was clear that, you know, that was a good opportunity to sort of look at this relationship we have with counties and figure out where can this work be done the most efficiently. And that really jumped out, and we've done that, and that's been successful. I think you may hear from others, from other proposals, not from the state agency, but to maybe do that a little bit more, maybe streamline more background study functions and move some more to the state from counties. There are jobs issues at the counties whenever we move work from the county to the state, but there are some efficiencies that we can gain. I think you'll see later when the language comes out, you'll see some proposals to change the way we do waiver licensing. Right now, some of the group homes that Representative Avar mentioned, the four-bed homes that are serving people with developmental disabilities, where there are also waiver services provided. Under the current model, counties do the licensing and monitoring of the adult foster care site, that home, and the state licenses the waiver program, the waiver services that go to many. And what you'll see is a proposal to work towards changing that over the next few years so that there is maybe one license and one agency that's doing it rather than having both. So we're cognizant of that, and we're trying, you know, all the time, and with technology. I think you'll hear a proposal at some point about an e-licensing proposal that will seek to mechanize a lot more of this through an online process that will help the state and the county be a little more combined. You know, and one of the things that we really aspire to is that it shouldn't matter so much who the boss is, but if all of the employees are properly matched and communicating well, you know, there shouldn't be inconsistent decisions made, and there shouldn't be overlap of duties. And so we're always looking to do some of that, but, you know, we're always open to ideas, too.
Thank you. Did you have a second page to talk about?
Yes.
And because we need to move a little bit.
Okay.
And we're enjoying the licensing discussion. You did mention language, though. Is that, do you have a predicted date for that? For when the language...
I did not.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the second page is page 19. And this is a proposal to, it's a new fee that we want to charge for some background studies that we're doing. I mentioned earlier the 2007 legislature moved some responsibilities for background studies from counties and private agencies to the state in response to the federal Adam Walsh Act. And you might recall that law requires that anybody who does foster care and anybody who's about to adopt a child in the United States needs to have a different kind of background study done, and it's consistently, the requirements are consistent across the country. And in order to do that, we have to do an FBI record check on absolutely everybody. And we also, if they've lived out of the state in the last 5 years, we need to check those other states to see if there's any child protection issues in those states. And so those are kind of costly. What we're trying to do here is charge a fee for those background studies that we do for private adoption agencies, not for counties when they're engaged in adoption activities, but only for private adoption agencies. And we would just recover the cost for those studies.
Any questions about that? I think if you move now, you'll escape. Thank you, Mr. Carver.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson. And just so members know our target here, we're limiting debate to an hour and 6 minutes. sorry. Because that's when we expire. But we'd like to get through this section if we could. Not to limit any questions, but we can always come back later, I guess. But that's the goal. And so, that was funny. Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
How many pages do I have to go through? Is there quite a lot of them?
Mr. Chair, I have 18 pages.
Okay, here, thanks.
And so there's the first six of these, hopefully, to be relatively quick, and some of the ones at the end, hopefully, relatively quick so we can meet the deadline.
Well, and we don't want to limit questions on important stuff. That's not the point either, but at least we know the target. Thanks. Go ahead. Proceed.
Mr. Chair, I'm starting on page 25. The first six proposals that I'm going to walk through...
Wait, Mr. Johnson, who are you again?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Chuck Johnson, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Human Services.
Thank you.
The first six pages are all about trying to simplify in different ways, simplify and streamline some of the work that we do, some of the work that the counties do in order to make it a little bit easier to deliver this complex set of programs that we're responsible for. And five of the six, I think, are pretty straightforward. One will probably require more discussion. On page 25, this is a proposal that would merge together two emergency assistance programs, the Emergency General Assistance Program and the Emergency Minnesota Supplemental Aid Program. In 2003, these two programs were capped. The funding for them was capped, and they were essentially block granted out to the counties on a formula allocation distributed to counties, the two separate programs. So a lot of overlap in the population served by the two programs. The relatively small EGA is $7.9 million. EMSA is $1.1 million a year. It would make it much easier for the counties to be able to manage them as a single program to serve emergency needs, mostly rent and damage deposits and utility kinds of costs for individuals without children, and that's the basic population that this serves. This would also create a eligibility limit of individuals under 200% of poverty being eligible for this. There is no limit right now. Counties would like to have that in order to help them, again, manage and prioritize the needs in their communities.
Keep going.
Mr. Chair, the next one is page 26. This is a proposal in the child support area. Currently in child support, when an obligor owes arrears, that is back child support that they haven't paid, and we're doing income withholding of their income in order to pay current support, we are required under the law to add on 20% to the amount we're collecting on the current support to also collect back the arrears that the individual owes. This makes sense. We want to collect arrears. The problem is that what often happens is when the obligor goes to court, the judge will write an order that both takes care of the current obligation for child support and adds on an amount for arrears. We're required under law to then add on another 20% administratively when we do income withholding. The result is the obligor comes out of court thinking they're responsible for a certain amount of money, then we add on 20% really for no particular purpose because the judge has already addressed the arrears that we're supposed to be addressing with this law. This proposal would say if the judge doesn't address the arrears, we will continue to add on the 20% to collect the arrears administratively. If the judge does address the arrears in the order, then we won't add on an additional amount and we will collect the amount that the judge has ordered. There's a cost on this page. The first piece of that is assistant cost in 2010 to make the adjustments in the system to implement this. The second piece is a small loss of revenue in the MFIP program from lower collections of arrears. It kind of evens out over time, so it goes away, as you can see, by 13.
Yeah, Representative Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you collect the arrears for non-custodial parents, that money goes back into the block grant? Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, the money goes back to either us if the arrears are for assistance that was paid when the person was on MFIP, or it goes back to the family, the custodial parent, if it was arrears from when the custodial parent was not on assistance.
Mr. Hayden. So when you say us, where specifically in the budget does that money go?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hayden, it shows up, two-thirds of first goes back to the federal government, and the other portion goes to reimburse the MFIP program. So it shows up as revenues coming in on the public assistance program.
Mr. Hayden.
Do we know how much money we collect each year?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hayden, overall we collect about $600 million each year. I don't have the figure in front of me for arrears, but we could get that to you.
And then I wanted to go back to the other page you went by that really quickly. I just have another quick question on emergency assistance. Have you ever figured out how much money you collect from damage deposits that were returned to people that moved into a place that you gave, you know, so you give people damage deposits. Have you figured out how much of that money has come back to you or come back to the individual when they move again?
Mr. Johnson. Mr. Chairman, Representative Caden, I don't believe that I know if we have that information. I'll look and see if anyone else knows. No, we can check and see if we have that information and provide it, otherwise let you know why it is we don't have it.
Mr. Johnson, do you take that back? I used to be a landlord in a different life, renting a lot of property 20 years ago. And we would get people coming on the emergency assistance and so on, and we'd get the money, and then we gave it back to them, I think, because it was their money. And
Mr. Chair, I believe that that's what happens. That I'm getting nods from the audience, so I don't think we try to collect that back.
Which is a thought you might consider if you're trying to...
Mr. Chair, I believe it's come up before. It gets fairly complicated to find and so forth. People,
they bang a hole in the wall and know how much they
have. Mr. Chair, you're reading my mind. I really do think that that's something that we should look at as a policy. It's been my experience that landlords that receive emergency assistance are from the county via us look at that as kind of a subsidy for renting the people that are poor. And that often, and sometimes legitimately they keep the money because there is damage to the apartment, but often they keep that money and never return it either back to the participant or the client and or to the state. That's been my experience as I've worked on these issues.
And Mr. Hayden, just since we're having our discussion back and forth here, if it's a county deal, as a landlord, happily forgetting how that was, if I was told that was county money and I could use it for damages and this rent and all, but if there's something left that goes back to the county, I would do that. And it wouldn't be that difficult to do because we have to give the money back to somebody. And when it's an extra bit of money, so it would go to the tenant or to the county. Just a thought.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I just think that we need to, if we're thinking about revenue generation and collecting fees, and all, in this kind of discussion, that has seemed to be something for me that if we're giving out all this money for emergency assistance, and I don't know what the figure is, I didn't look at it deeply, but if someone moves in the next year and they haven't damaged the unit, that money should be accounted for. So if it goes back to the individual, then when they come for emergency assistance again, we should ask them where that money is and that they should use that money for their next apartment, or it should come back to the county or to the state. And I just think that is a huge loophole. And as you stated, Commissioner, it's quite complicated. It may be complicated, but it is a certain amount of money that goes out the door that we don't account for, and people come back again and again and again to get damaged deposits.
That's the right man for the job. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and he sounds like a fiscal conservative to me. You never know where you're going to find one. But what I wanted to ask is about the implementation of this, and if I understood you, is it $200,000 to implement this, or is part of that the actual funds that wouldn't be collected?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, it's $170,000 is the cost for the implementation.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, I just really would like an explanation of why it should cost that. I mean, I know when the department wants to change some computer thing, it's always costed out at some enormous amount of money, but this is just give me a computer and I could probably figure this out. I don't understand why it should cost $170,000. Can you explain that?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Liebling, no, not specifically. I can't explain that. I can explain that the system that supports the collection of child support is very complicated because the regulations around child support collection are very complicated and it needs to accommodate and account for all those complexities. And it is, it does take time and effort to change it. And you're absolutely correct. When we make changes, a lot of the changes that are made around here end up with the system's fiscal note because we need to change the system to do what it is the new policy is intended to do.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could just continue with that for just a bit more. You know, I've had a little experience with that in prior sessions, getting, you know, some little change in child support, and I realize that there's a cost to doing that, but it just seems like where it's a very simple change, that there shouldn't be this kind of programming cost. And if there really is, then I think that's a problem right there. I don't know why, why we have a system where some minor change is such a major deal to accomplish. And I guess I'd like some more information on that. I really would like to know how many hours is that? You know, who's going to do it? Is that department employees that are already, you know, what are we paying them an hour, and how many hours are they going to take to get this minor change?
Mr. Chairman, we can get you that information.
Please.
They'd even give you a personal meeting if you wanted to talk to the person in charge. There'd be a fiscal note for the meeting, yes. Mr. Hayden, do you have any advice about how to solve this one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm over here with my colleague, Representative Liebling, so we're going to ask a few questions today. Thank you, Commissioner. I wanted to ask another question about child support, in particular in the collections method. It's my understanding we have a policy or a program called the SHLIF program that speaks to the arrears. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and how that may affect our collections of child support?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hayden, SHLIF is supporting low-income families, is what the acronym stands for. And it's an initiative that we put together in working with the counties that focuses on those obligors who don't have a lot of money and have trouble paying the child support. When we think of child support and the enforcement, we have folks who can't pay and we have folks who won't pay. And a lot of the program is set up around those who won't pay, trying to enforce, find those guys, get their money, that kind of a thing. This is really on those who really don't have a lot of money to pay and how we do a better job of more working with them. Because often what happens with the lower income obligors is they, for a variety of reasons, may not be in court when the initial obligation is set. And so someone else is imputing how much they think they ought to pay with not correct information on how much that individual is actually making or whatever else may be going on. And then they immediately fall behind, they get frustrated, they don't pay, and you end up getting a lot of arrears and not a lot of collections going on. So this is in part to try to engage the low-income obligors, working with counties, working with communities. We're working with Department of Corrections on individuals who are coming back into the community out of the correction system. Many of them owe child support, trying to adjust that. We're looking at how we will adjust arrears, that is, adjust down arrears if someone is making progress on paying current support, as a way to incent the obligors to be more cooperative. But also part of just making sure that obligation, and sometimes you have to get the guy back into court, is set at a level that he can actually pay. I mean, it's usually he, but not always. And so it's really an initiative to try to do better on our collections from the lower income part of our caseload by trying to work more cooperatively and more broadly with others in the community on working with that population.
That's been Hayden.
So how are we implementing that? I guess one question is, has it been successful? And number two, if it hasn't been successful, how are we going to be able to get that message out to those people who may be in that position, those non-custodial parents, I believe?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, we've implemented it mostly by sort of setting up suggested changes that counties can make and then working with counties to help them implement those changes in how they deliver the services, as well as I mentioned working with the Department of Corrections, with the Fathers Network, and other organizations, that are involved with these individuals in the community. It has been successful, and I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but we had a drop in arrears, the total amount of arrears that the state is owed, or anyone is owed over the course of time, which I believe is about $1.7 billion. That dropped for the first time in 20 years this year, which we think is in part because of SHLIF and in part because of getting those obligations lined up better for those low-income obligors. So that's, I can get you the specific numbers on that. I don't have it right here. But we do think that we've been successful getting this started. For the counties, it's kind of another thing to do, so it takes some work to get them to understand how we have to try to work this into the work we have to do of enforcing child support. But we think it's a very positive direction to be moving.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hayes.
I've heard about the program. I would like to know those numbers, and I think that that is something that as we move forward and we talk about job stimulus and job creation, I have a lot of people that come to talk to me about this issue of owing. I think it goes in specifically into your 20% withholding, as well as folks, you know, setting someone setting limits in terms of what they owe that may not be fair. So I'm glad that the system is working a little better and that hopefully we can get folks better in line so that they can get back to work.
$1.7 billion. If we could annuitize that, just think we could turn that into cash. Okay, any other questions? The page 3 we're going to move on to.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm on, now on page 28. This is a page that proposes changes to the Diversionary Work Program and Family Stabilization Services. These are two programs, Diversionary Work Program and Family Stabilization, are essentially sub-programs within the MSIP umbrella of what we do with our Welfare Reform Initiative. Diversionary Work Program was created in 2003. It's for new applicants. It's very work-focused. The intent is to try to get new applicants who can go to work quickly, to work as quickly as possible so they don't have to come on to MSIP. It's a four-month kind of front end for MSIP for those that are most job ready. Family Stabilization Services was created in 2007. That's for the part of the caseload in MSIP who have the most challenges and most barriers to employment. They're not able to work, not able to meet the work participation rates. It's more of a case management model of working with those families to try to help them get in a position where hopefully they can be successful in work, but we know that that's not happening right now. So in a sense, it's two completely separate ends of the spectrum of the caseload, those that are real job ready and those that have the most barriers. What happened, though, is where the two programs interact, we actually have people who can be on DWP and family stabilization at the same time. That doesn't make a lot of sense from a policy perspective, and it's very challenging for the counties to figure out how they get a DWP person in the family stabilization kinds of services. Essentially, what this page does is just changes it so that when a family comes in who might otherwise, under current law, be on DWP, they will go right into MSIP and family stabilization if that eligibility alignment makes, if they would otherwise be eligible for the family stabilization. Technically, what that means is that we're expanding slightly the categories in the Diversionary Work Program, what's called unlikely to succeed. When an individual comes into DWP, a county can determine that not a family is likely to benefit from DWP, move them into MSIP, and in this case into MSIP with Family Stabilization Services as a complement. It's just trying to get better alignment across our programs, and there's a small savings that results.
And the saving comes from the MA.
The savings, Mr. Chair, comes because it puts a few more families on the MSIP instead of DWP, and the DWP benefits are slightly higher than the MSIP benefits on average.
Thank you. Any questions about that? Yeah, Representative Bond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I was a little confused about that explanation because I view the DWP, you're selecting people who are highly likely to be able to move on quickly, and that I can't imagine why that other group would be overlapping with this group at all, unless it was just a budgetary, you know, gimmick of some sort to deal with certain matching funds or whatever. So I'm puzzled by this whole line of discussion. So.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the Diversionary Work Program, essentially if you're a new applicant coming in, by default you're in Diversionary Work Program. There has to be a conscious determination made that you don't belong there. Mm-hmm. And so it's trying to make sure that the language and law that tells who can be diverted out of the Diversionary Work Program is aligned with the family stabilization eligibility criteria.
He said a list of, little longer list of who doesn't go to it then,
right? Right.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the, Commissioner Johnson, on the FSF program, who pays for that? Where does that money come from? Does it come from the TANF grant or does it come from general fund?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hayden, the services in the family stabilization, the services that the individuals receive or the families receive, are funded by the counties using the MSIP consolidated funds, essentially a block grant of money that goes to the counties to support the work they do, delivering MSIP services. That block grant is mostly TANF. There's a small amount of general fund in it. The benefits that individuals receive through DWP or MSIP are a combination of TANF and general fund.
So what happens to the families that are deemed not successful for work and have hit the 60-month time limit?
Mr. John.
As a family approaches the 60-month, I'm sorry, Mr. Sherman Smith Hayden, as the family approaches the 60-month time limit, there's a process in law that starts at the 48th month that a county goes through to determine whether or not the individual is eligible for an extension beyond the 60 months, which are based on disability or caring for someone with a disability, mental health, learning disability, developmental disability. And there's also a category for individuals who are working or meeting the work requirements that would allow them to be extended past the 60 months. So it's similar categories of sort of identifying, you know, who's having challenges. In fact, I think they're aligned in some cases directly in the law. But it's sort of a separate process that happens at the end of the program as the family's approaching the 60th month.
Okay, thank you. These are the easy pages, huh? Okay, yes, move on here, Ken.
Mr. Chair, the next page is page 29. This is a page that aligns our policies around overpayments and the policies for how we collect overpayments. We discovered recently that within the programs that we run, the Minnesota Family Investment Program, Food Stamps, General Assistance, and Minnesota Supplemental Aid, we have different policies for how we do overpayments. There's no particular reason to have different policies. Overpayments result when there's an error made either by the worker, the county worker, or by the client that results from the client getting more money than they're supposed to. In those instances, we set up an overpayment claim and try to get the money paid back that's been overpaid. What this page addresses is how far back we look when we're calculating what the overpayment is. And what we discovered is we had different ways of doing that in different programs. This aligns all the programs around what we currently do within MFIP, which is if the agency made the error, we look back 1 year in calculating, up to 1 year, in calculating what the overpayment would be. If the client made the error, we look back 6 years, up to 6 years, in looking at what the overpayment would be calculated to be. In both cases, this does not cover an intentional program violation or fraud. In that instance, we look back to whenever the violation happened, an entire overpayment would be taken into consideration. Just one clarification or correction to this page. This shows as an increase in revenue. It is all, actually a loss of revenue. So it should be a $7,000 cost on the bottom line rather than a $7,000 savings on the bottom line.
Any questions about this? You're on a roll.
Mr. Chair, I'll try to keep going. Next proposal addresses the fraud prevention program. This is an initiative that was started in 1990 as a pilot and now operates in 55 counties. It's an initiative that was really just to look at a new way of enforcing fraud by using essentially administrative and civil tools rather than using the more traditional criminal investigation and criminal prosecution kind of tools. The program currently, as I said, operates in 55 counties. There are 31 investigators who last year did about 6,500 investigations. The current program is funded by grants from the department that are about $1.5 million. So $1.5 million annually in state funds. The counties are able to pull down federal funds to supplement that for a total program budget of around $2.8 million annually. What's happening over time with this program as we move forward is with flat state funding, the counties are getting pressed more and more to continue to deliver the same level of service for the flat amount of money as their costs increase and staff costs increase over time. Eventually, we need to come up with a solution for how we're going to address that. If we continue in the direction we're going, we will have fewer counties delivering services or fewer investigations being done, or the counties will have to absorb more costs in order to keep us at the level of service that we now have in the program. In looking at alternatives around how to address this problem, we are proposing that the state take over the FPI program and that we do the investigations as part of our duties at the department. This would be effective November 1, 2009, and we propose that we would have fully implemented and phased in by the February 1st of 10. It would be about cost neutral. You can see from the page the small savings. We believe that with the same amount of money that we're currently funding for the 55 counties, that we can cover the entire state through using a state workforce and targeting resources, and that we can do more investigations in total. The current program, with a variation among the counties, last year, we did about 17 investigations per investigator per month. But if you look at the range, those that were operating at a higher level were able to do 25 to 30 investigations per investigator per month. We believe that by doing it statewide, we can get up more into that 25 to 30 range and thus do as many investigations or even more than we're doing now with the county-based program. We also believe we can direct and prioritize resources more effectively by doing this at the state level, and we can ensure more consistency and develop procedures across the state that are more consistent in how we enforce fraud.
Thank you. Representative Slavik has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, he's a familiar face in our committee because he is also over all the early childhood accounts that relate to DHS. Members, I just want to let you know that I have a constituent that is totally against this. Just want to know that. And that we're meeting tomorrow about it with that constituent, and that he has posed about 10 different questions to Mr. Johnson, and we're working our way through this. AFSCME is also against this, and the group, he's part of the group of the current investigators, and they are against this state takeover. So I just want to make sure the members know that and understand that. Also, since we're having a meeting tomorrow, if you need a resource, please know that I'm working on it already. And Mr. Johnson, to you, a question I don't understand is, why are the budget pages, why is part of this in this committee, part of this is in my committee, and part of it must be somewhere else, right? So what? Why is it split up among these different...
Mr. Chair and Representative Slawick, I might ask you that question. The committee and the House are presented the proposal to. I can sort of give you, as I understand the piece here, which is the... there's a piece of it that is child care money that supports the child care investigations, which is under the jurisdiction of your committee. The current grant that we give to the counties is under the jurisdiction of Representative Clark's housing committee, because she has some of other miscellaneous accounts within DHS. Where the proposal would end up being is under the jurisdiction of this committee, because it would be within our administrative account. And the policy is human services policy, and I assume would be in Representative Peason's committee. So that, I think, is the breakdown as I understand it.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Well, the question is, where would you like to have a hearing? Because I know I'd love to have one in my committee on this issue. But when we assume these are coming out in terms of bills. Is there a bill coming out specifically on this? Or are you, I think somebody else asked you about how the bills are being split up, and do you have any idea how that's coming together? Is it going to be part of the major bill?
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, it will be part of the major budget bill that will be coming. And as far as the hearing, as long as it's only one of them, I don't mind which committee it's in.
Mr. Johnson, I thought maybe we could have several, but that's okay. We'll have to think about that. If Representative Huntley's not here, but we need to think about where we're going to hear this, and we would be very interested in this. Mr. Johnson, I just have one other question. Yesterday, all the fiscal chairs are being asked to approach the commissioners and the departments asking for a prioritization of their programs and their budgets. We sent that letter. I don't know if you've received that.
Mm-hmm.
And Ms. Martineau, who's out in the audience. I just wondered, are you going to all be responding to the different commissioners as you get these letters and let us know a high, a medium, and a low priority on these programs and how you see them falling?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fluff, we haven't had a chance to discuss internally how we're going to look at responding to that, so I think we need to do that first. And I'm not sure which other committees we've gotten them from, so we sort of need to get together on one page of how we're going to approach it.
Because you have never said the word falling.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Smiley.
I mentioned that in front of the committee just so you know it would be very helpful for us to know how you view all this on a high, medium, and low, and then how we all view this on a high, medium, low, and then obviously there's going to be a bunch of cuts made after that. So any consideration is appreciated.
And Representative Smiley, you can always call Bill to your committee.
Pardon me?
You can always invite Mr. Johnson with the Bill to your committee and just have to ask Representative Carlson and off it goes, I think.
Representative Abler, he's in front of our committee a lot,
yeah.
But it's a matter of one more time. I think we definitely would like to hear have this in front of our committee. So thank you.
Representative Hyde. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Johnson. I have the same concerns that Representative Slavik has. I've had several people contact me on this issue with what the centralization of fraud investigators will mean. You're actually reducing the amount of fraud investigators, and the assumptions made I hope can be substantiated in some way. If I'm correct, investigations into CCA services and Minnesota Care is currently done under the purview of DHS, and maybe they can give us some comparative numbers on what kind of money was collected in those investigations, how many investigations a month in Minnesota Care and PCA services and all those areas. I mean, right now we're pretty much essentially going off of assumptions that we'll be able to get increased services for less amount of money. Secondly, I think geographic challenges are also something we should consider. Maybe doing 30 investigations a month in Hennepin County is a lot easier than doing 30 investigations a month up in the northern part of Minnesota. And currently with the county-based system, we have the counties be able to make the priorities that fit their needs. One question that I do have, Mr. Chair, is currently some counties do, I believe, independently have fraud investigators outside of the appropriation from the state level. Would this make that more challenging for those counties?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Senapash, there are, I believe, three or four counties that fund FBI in some way on their own. They could continue to do that or not under this, but just as they can now, it's been their choice to do that. And they could or couldn't, and it might depend on whether they believe they're getting the kind of service that they want from the state or whether they want to have something more intensive going on in their county. I should also say, counties are also over the, not the FBI part of fraud, but what's called fraud control. That's still going to be an entirely county-operated and directed kind of activity, which is more the investigator, often in the sheriff's office, that kind of activity. This fraud prevention initiative is more working closely on the financial assistance side of the program with the financial workers to identify when there are irregularities that might warrant investigation for possible fraud.
Mr. Chair, a question that I have, and I know it can't be answered now, but since the claims of an average of 28 investigations could be completed per investigator, and that there'd be a wider geographic area covered, if you could provide us with the performance numbers along the lines of the other areas that the department is responsible for those investigations to see if they line up with your.
Mr. Rumsfeld Hosh, I can, and I can tell you that this activity we're proposing will be run out of the same unit that does the Minnesota Care work. And last year, the Minnesota Care investigators in that unit did about 27 investigations per month per investigator.
Representative Lieberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that started to kind of dovetail nicely with what I wanted to ask, which was just to. I just want to know a little bit more about who's doing the investigations now and who would be doing them at the state level. And when I say who, I mean, what qualification do they have? Because I'm thinking about if there are prosecutions, those have to be done by the county anyway, I assume. And so, who interacts with the county attorneys now and who would do it under this new scheme?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, there is variation now within the county. In some cases, it's an employee of the Human Services part of the county. In some cases, the sheriff's employee who does this work. And all the people that we would hire would have investigator qualifications and experience. We did create an investigator class, which we're doing when we pick up the Minnesota Care investigation. So we have that existing set of standards for our process for hiring staff. I'm not forgetting the other part of your question. Oh, in terms of interacting with the counties, interacting with the counties would be key to making this work. We think you need to be on the ground working with the counties, and our investigators would be out in the field doing that kind of work. This FBI is not as directed toward prosecution. It's directed more toward claims, recovery, program disqualification as the way to address fraud, in part because it's so much easier and less costly to do that than to do prosecution. When there's a case of a size that warrants prosecution, or a county attorney otherwise decides they want to get involved in prosecution, our staff would have to work then with the county attorney because they'd be the ones that would be following through and doing the prosecution if that were the tack that were being taken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Commissioner Johnson has pretty adequately answered most of the question that I have. Depending on your frame of reference, fraud prevention, fraud suspicion, just the very words are fairly popular in some of our communities. I'm hoping that if this budget page gets through this process, those nasty ads that some of us have in our local newspapers, suspect welfare fraud, call the county, and a phone number is there and all of that. I'm hoping that some of that will go away, but I suspect that those ads are not through the human services process and system and funding, but rather through the sheriff's department. And that's a whole other problem. You'd think those folks would have other things to do.
That's probably a comment. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question, Mr. Johnson. Can you just help me, from a practical standpoint, understand where these investigators would be housed? So would they be centrally located here and then do their work via the computer, or would they, you know, would they be co-located in the jurisdictions? It just is hard for me to wrap my hands around someone doing fraud investigation on the range from St. Paul. I mean, could you help me with that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden. Some of them would be located, actually live outside of the metro area. So we expect that some would be, but it depends in part on who we end up hiring as to where we may locate people. But we expect we will need to have some people actually living, you know, out and working out in the field. We will have other people who will be working out in the field that may be stationed from St. Paul, but will spend a fair amount of their time out in the field. And we would look for counties to help with temporary housing of people that need a place to sit for a day to do some of their work. We would have essentially kind of a temporary housing shared space at St. Paul for the investigators when they did need to be in the office. So certainly technology will help a lot with this. The ability, a lot of investigation can be done online at the computer, given the tools that we have to investigate fraud. So that piece of it still would be done in that way.
Mr. Johnson, I think I'll have the last question on this one. You drew a winner here on this question, Chair. Would the people, and I'm not familiar with some of the controversy, I suppose I'll hear about it later, but aren't some of the people that you might hire some of the same people that were working for counties before to be part of this new team, right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. They with the investigative experience they have, they would be prime candidates.
And they'd be state employees and in the same, would they get a better or lower wage, do you think, than they were getting at their own?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that. We haven't got that deep into it.
We got a fiscal note, right? Oh, it's part of the art, I'm sorry.
The labor issue.
I delayed too long.
Yes, you did, Mr. Chair. Well, that kind of begs the question, are some of these union employees that would then be non-union employees, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, they would all be union employees as state employees. Well, because a supervisor would be in MMA.
Talk to Pandora.
I don't know the current unionization of those who are currently doing this work.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, I was told yesterday it would go from AFSCME to MATE, so it would be sort of a switch in unions. That would be, but I don't know. Yeah, something like that.
Okay, I think we're stopping. Love them both. So stick with my friends on that one. Would you go to the next page quickly, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Page 32. This relates to how appeals are handled for revenue recapture. What currently happens in a situation, I discussed overpayments before, where a client may have an overpayment. We send them a notice saying you have an overpayment of X amount. They can appeal that overpayment. If the overpayment goes to a certain point and they haven't paid, we may use, working with the Department of Revenue, revenue recapture, that is grabbing their tax return to help pay off this overpayment they had in the public assistance area. If they can also appeal that action. What happens right now is if they appeal the Department of Human Services overpayment action, that appeal would come to the appeals referees at the Department of Human Services. If they appeal the revenue recapture action, that appeal goes to the Office of Administrative Hearings. So the appeal on what is essentially the same action ends up in two different places. The Office of Administrative Hearings doesn't have a lot of experience with DHS appeals. That's a complication. The counties have to pay the Office of Administrative Hearings to handle their appeals, which means the county sometimes won't pursue the appeal and follow through on it on their end if they have to pay to have the hearing happen. What we're asking for here is the authority to have both pieces of that appeal be done by the DHS appeals referees in one place. DEED currently has this kind of authority for the revenue recapture and the overpayments that they do within their system. We'll just be giving us a similar kind of authority that DEED has.
The budget on this is a half FTE of added work for our appeals unit, which is more than offset by additional collections we believe we'll get because we'll be able to handle more appeals because the counties will bring them forward because they won't have to avoid the costs that they do now when they go to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and the counties would also save some money in the process.
You put the judge's pay there, which is kind of cool. Fast time for a little moonlighting job again. $150 an hour. Okay, that's probably imputed staff time. Any questions about this? Move while you can, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, the next page is page 36. This is the adoption assistance relative custody assistance forecast. Adoption assistance, relative custody assistance are two programs that we use to pay for permanency for children in the child welfare system. These are programs that when a child has been removed from the home and parental rights have been terminated or they otherwise can't return to their birth family, we pursue permanency for a permanent legal situation for that child. Adoption assistance where it's appropriate, where parental rights have been terminated, where a relative can step in and take guardianship or custody of the child, we pursue in that direction. These programs pay assistance to the families to offset the cost of taking on the additional child. Many of these children, all these children have been through some form of maltreatment. Many of them have disabilities as well. This is a program that under the way the federal law is set up, adoption assistance, we have to serve everyone who is eligible. It is essentially an entitlement. But it is not for the purposes of state budgeting considered a forecasted program. So instead of showing up in the forecast like some of our other programs do, we have to come every 2 years and ask for the additional funding to get us continue on the path of these programs in the direction they're going. And so that's why you see this before you. I would provide additional piece of information, which is in fiscal years 10 and 11 of the cost that you're seeing on the page here, which is around $13 million in total, $5.1 million per year, about $10 million of that cost, is actually base cost that was not funded in the 07 budget when the legislature did the 07 budget. So about of this $13 million, about $10 million is really base cost, and only $3 million is the growth in the forecast. But we had to make up the base because it wasn't funded previously. I'd also mention that this page interacts with the North Star Care for Children, which I'm going to discuss in a few minutes.
I'm just puzzled on the method of it. If it's an entitlement, why is it in the forecast? How did that, we appropriated it and we just didn't appropriate it?
Mr. Chair, it's one of those things where you have to go through a process to make a program forecasted versus not, and we've never been successful in getting it designated as a forecasted program.
Even though we have to do it.
Even though we have to do it, correct.
That's really interesting. Are there other programs like this?
I believe alternative care is similar. In that there's requests every year that come through on it, but I'm
that's not an entitlement though. That's a is that an optional program?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I probably shouldn't go into
never
it.
Never mind. We're not going to that. We've already had those pages. Any questions about this? Representative Haka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. When I'm looking through the proposal notes, this is using basic sliding fee child care assistance dollars, and it says that the remaining funds after funding these pilots will be refinanced back into child care assistance and then back into the general fund. Do you anticipate that there will be remaining funds and how much of that would be refinanced?
Mr. Chair, I believe you're asking about a page that I actually skipped because it's under the jurisdiction of the Early Ed Committee.
I'm sorry. Yeah, are we on page, Mr. Chair, are we on page 34?
36.
Okay. You are very correct.
Yes, never mind.
Representative Flowick, if you can ask that question. Representative Flowick, do you have a question you want to ask?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hush, you're on to something there and we'll talk about it. Okay.
We need the bullet in that one. Okay, any questions about this page? Okay, why don't you move along forward?
Mr. Chair, the next two pages that we're going to look at form a basis for important proposals to underline some continuation of progress we've made in our child welfare system. We think these are significant initiatives we'd like to move forward with this year. We made a lot of progress in the last few years in our child welfare system. We are nation-leading in terms of the alternative response, differential response initiative that we put in place several years ago. We've also moved to using much more early intervention, working with the counties and trying to address issues with families before it gets to the point where they're ending up in the child welfare system. We're dealing with children who have been maltreated and have had a lot of success in that area as well.
We've also made a significant assessment in the permanency area and continue to work really hard on getting older children in particular placed in adoptions and to permanency. But we continue to face many challenges. We have much stronger federal oversight coming through the Children and Family Services review process. And that process continues to look at closely at our permanency work in particular and want us to do better in terms of getting kids to permanency quickly. We also have issues with disproportionality for African-American, American Indian kids in our foster care system that we're continuing to work with the counties to address, but are the challenge that we're facing. We also have issues with the ongoing fiscal capacity of the system. Most of you know that the counties are responsible for and fund over half of the cost of the child welfare system. State is actually less than 20%. We're a relatively small player fiscally in what goes on in the system. But we need to look at how we're using our resources from the state level in order to make sure we're doing the best we can in meeting the needs of kids. If we do nothing and it changes within the child welfare system, over the next 10 years, 90,000 children will enter foster care. 15,000 children will return to foster care because they weren't able to be successful at permanency. And nearly 6,000 teens will end up aging out of foster care at the age of 18 without having ever achieved permanency. What we're proposing to do in the next two pages are two important initiatives. The first is to establish a single benefit for permanency, and the second is to restructure the Child and Community Services Act to support a new act called Protecting Children and Safe Families. The first page that you have on page 38 is the Child Permanency North Star Care for Children. This proposal creates a single benefit for children who have been removed from their homes, unifying the policy, benefits, and rate-setting structure and the financing for foster care adoption assistance and relative custody assistance. It supports relative custody and adoption by removing the financial disincentives in the current program, and it streamlines and simplifies the administration across these three programs. Right now, we have three programs that provide care for children when they're removed from the home or outside of the home. Foster care, which is for kids who are removed from the home when there's a concern about their safety within the child welfare system, which includes long-term foster care, where kids can end up if there's no permanency for them after their parental rights have been terminated. Adoption assistance, which I just talked about, which provides assistance to kids when they're adopted out of the foster care system. And relative custody assistance, which provides assistance to relatives who take custody of children when they can't be returned to their home. When children are removed from the home, our singular focus is on trying to get them to permanency. And when we can, that means reunifying them with their biological parents, and that happens about 80% of the time. When it doesn't happen, we then need to find permanency for the kids in other ways. What happens now under our current system is we have the financial disincentive backwards in this program. The rates for foster care, what we pay a foster parent, are about twice the rates that we pay under adoption assistance and relative custody assistance. In fact, the National Council of Adoption says that we have the biggest percentage differential in the nation across all states between our adoption assistance rates and our foster care rates, the largest gap between those two. This is a disincentive for moving kids into permanency. It's particularly a disincentive for a foster parent to adopt a child, and often the foster parent who has been caring for a child is the best and most likely candidate to want to adopt the child and take them into their home. And yet we have the incentive set up backwards. What this proposal does is it creates a single program called the North Star Care for Children. This new program will be simpler and will provide a continuum of support for children. It would start with a single unified assessment tool. Right now, each of these three programs has a different way of assessing what the needs of the children are. We are developing, working with counties, a single unified assessment tool that will be used across all programs to identify what are the child's needs, which will then drive what kind of rate we would provide to the family to support that child. The three sort of doors into the program, foster care, adoption assistance, and relative custody, would remain the same as they are now, although we changed the relative custody to the term guardianship, which is a term that's used under the new federal law, fostering connections, which we are trying to align with as part of this proposal. We would also have a unified set of rates across the three programs that we would pay families. If you look on page 39, you can see the table that shows the rates that we're proposing for this program. On the left-hand side of the table, you can see the current rates, starting with the basic rates up in the corner, for foster care, relative custody assistance, and adoption assistance. And you can see what I was saying about the differential is when you have the 0 to 5 age kid, foster care, the basic rate is $5.98 a month,
and relative custody and adoption assistance is only 247. For each of those programs, there are also supplementary rates. If you look at the bottom side, bottom left-hand side of the table, you can see for foster care, there are actually 225 different supplementary rates that a family could get for caring for a child. And that's all determined through a complicated process that counties go through with the family to determine what the needs of the kids are and what the and what that results in. For adoption assistance and relative custody assistance, there are four different levels of supplementary rates that are paid, although adoption assistance also has some add-ons to that that are not listed here. This proposal, if you look on the right-hand side of the table, will propose a single set of benefits, where the basic benefit will be split into three categories by age at the top of the table, and the supplemental benefits would only be 10 in number, not 225 in number, and would be as listed there in A through J. This is a way of essentially evening out the benefits across the three programs. It is, as you can see by looking at the budget numbers here, a basically cost-neutral way of doing that. That means that the foster care rates are going to come down compared to what we currently pay for some families, but the permanency payments for adoption assistance and all the custody assistance will go up for all the people who are in those programs. The financing of this program would actually have to be a shared state-county financing on the non-federal share of it, and that is something that we will work out as part of this process. We'll actually have different shares for the converted cases, those that sort of come in from the old system into the new system, versus how we will share costs for new cases going forward. And we'll use actual data from fiscal years 8 through 10 to determine what those shares are for the state county and for the counties relative to each other and how much they have to pay. The new program will be effective January 1st of 2011. There is a phase-in period that's built into that to help us get all the families in. A few adoption assistance cases would probably stay with the current adoption assistance program. Adoption assistance under the federal law requires us to negotiate individual agreements with families. We can't break that agreement unilaterally. If the family wants to stay in adoption assistance, they can. And in a few cases, they may get more money in adoption assistance than they would in the new program, so we expect they would probably stay in the old program. The fiscal on this, there are essentially three pieces. The 2010 cost that you see here is a systems cost of making the changes to support the new single benefit program. The rest of it, when fully implemented, is, if you look at the bottom line, relatively cost neutral. $113,000 cost in 254 in 12 and 13. But there is a trade there that's going on. On the current relative custody assistance program, when a family comes in and applies for relative custody assistance, we first send them over to see if they're eligible for MFIP child only. And if they are eligible for MFIP child only, relative custody only pays at whatever be above that cost of the MFIP child only. Within the new system, in part because the federal government will begin to pay FFP on relative custody assistance, which they don't now, we will keep the two programs separate. And when a family comes in and applies what we will call guardianship, they will just get the dollars through the guardianship. We will hopefully get FFP where we can on it, but we won't send them over to get the MFIP. So we're taking the MFIP connection out of this, which means we will see a resulting decrease in the MFIP caseload, and that's what's represented by those two offsetting numbers that you see on the page, which is actually TANF dollars, the savings from fewer of these child-only cases being served, and then the proposal that would refinance those dollars to create general fund savings so that it nets out to zero.
Mr. Anzalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is major good stuff here on these two pages. First question, is there any, is the federal share Title 20, and how does, and if so, how does that get to the counties, and how do they draw down Title 20? Is per client, per unit of service, how does that work? And then the county share, hate to use the word mandate, but this is a case where mandate, you know, would be a good thing. Is a very good thing to require a county share to serve these children in this kind of a program. I'd just like to know how that works. Because this is a federal, state, and county partnership. Right?
Mr. Sheriff Zanzel, that's absolutely correct. The federal reimbursement here is Title 4E. Supports foster care, it all supports adoption assistance.
With legislation that was about to pass last year, over time we will be able to get federal reimbursement on relative custody guardianship, which we can't now. We'll also be able to get more federal reimbursement under adoption assistance than we can now. But it stays in over 9 years, so kind of the fiscal effect is slow, but the policy direction is correct. Counties get these dollars now for foster care. We get them for adoption assistance. It's a case-by-case basis. It's a fairly complicated kind of process, but the counties know how to do it, and we know how to do it. And so that's how we access the federal dollars through 4E.
It's about thrift and Anvil.
So you can separate Title 20 dollars for other services.
Mr. Hero, from Anvil, Title 20 dollars are coming on the next page I'm going to talk about. To your question about the county, our estimate at this point is that when we get into the going forward piece with new cases coming in, that the non-federal share would be about 60% county and 40% state. That's about how we think it would work out. For the families that are converted over from the old programs, we developed a method of determining what the proportional cost that each county had. They would retain that proportional cost, but those converted costs would go down over time and eventually disappear.
Assembly Wynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a kind of a quick question, I think. Right now, are the payments for these various programs the same across the state? It doesn't matter where you live. You get the same thing for foster care, same thing for adoption assistance, and so on.
Mr. Sherman said, Liebling, they are the same, although there ends up being variation by county in terms of how the negotiation process may work and what kind of special rates might be added based on how a particular county approaches different cases. But the rates are the same from a policy level.
Okay, so thank you, Mr. Chair. So the implication of that is that to the degree they're not standard across the state now, they would be after this big change?
Mr. Chair, within leaving, that's correct. And we hope there'd be more consistency in how the supplemental rate process is done by having the one universal assessment for how we do this that would be simpler and more directly focused on children's needs. We think that will help in ensuring more consistency as well across the state.
Okay, keep going.
Mr. Chair, the next page is Protecting Children Act on page 41 of your book. This is a proposal we also think is important to keep continuing our move forward within the child welfare system. It is also a revenue-neutral page. In 2003, the legislature created the Child and Community Services Act, and that was created out of a number of grants that existed at that time. It also includes the Title 20 Social Services Block Grant funding as part of it. That's where those dollars are now. What this page does is takes 55% of that dollars, which is about $55 million, around $100 million block grant currently, and moves it under something we are calling the Protecting Children by Supporting Safe and Stable Families Act. This would focus those dollars on the child welfare system and on children's needs. That is mostly how the counties are spending this money now. That part is not a change. There's only a change in the sense of how we're going to drive those dollars. This would be effective also January 1 of 2011. This act would prioritize state's funding, particularly toward those kind of front-end services that we think are so important to ensuring that we can keep kids out of the child welfare system and out of the deep-end services, out of foster care in particular. To prioritize funding for support for at-risk families, for the families who can get help through an alternative assessment response instead of an investigative kind of response, and also for post-permanency services to ensure that when a kid is placed in permanency, we can keep the child there, whether it's with their biological family or with a new family after parental rights have been terminated. This proposal would also commit us to a strong set of performance standards that we would hold ourselves and the counties to in terms of improving over time how we're delivering services in the child welfare area. And this would be somewhat reflective of what the federal government is currently doing. It would also include a focus on how we reduce disparities and hold ourselves accountable for trying to reduce disparities and disproportionality within the system. It would also institutionalize what we have already started, which is the system of quality assurance, where we work with the counties on ensuring that the quality within the program and make corrective action where there are problems that need to be addressed. The remainder of the CCSA block grant will be split up, again, based on current county spending into four different pieces, which address the areas of aging and disability, chemical dependency, adult mental health, and children's mental health.
Mr. Johnson, I remember this when it came around, and that was when we
there was a reduction in funding, but it was block grants for flexibility, and then there was money that was going to go back up, and I told them it was never going to go back up, and it didn't because other things took its place. Are the counties that aren't, can't they figure this out themselves, or we don't trust them, or is that what you're telling us?
Well, Mr. Chair, we do, I think, trust the counties for the most part on this. I would say that what we're trying to do here, and it really applies back to the North Star page as well, we have two places where we have money in the child welfare system as a state. In the adoption assistance relative custody area, which we combine in with the North Star proposal, and in the area of CCSA. And our concern is, ideally, the child welfare system could probably use more money, but that isn't going to happen. Absent that, what we want to do is make the best use we can of the dollars that we have and do the best that we can to make sure we're using those dollars wisely to get the kind of outcomes and to address the kind of priority services that we think are most important for the kids in Minnesota. And while the flexibility we tried to create in 2003 wasn't necessarily a bad idea for that time, we're feeling now like going forward, we need to be more clear about what we as the state funder want to see within the system with the dollars we have and leverage as much as we can trying to create the improvements we need to see in the system.
Do you have some idea about what the counties won't be able to do, what they've been doing already with some of this? You're going to be shifting priorities, and you know, this is all about choosing priorities, and you're bringing a proposal. We have ideas. They have their ideas. Do you know what things that they would not be doing now that they're doing?
Mr. Chair, I don't think it's a matter of necessarily restricting them from doing things that they're doing or not doing now. This would affect different counties differently depending on how they prioritize the funding within the overall CCSA by taking, we put the total up here based on county spending in 07 and the percentages that it was spent in 07, but individual counties may have had very different patterns of spending. Now, to some extent, in the child welfare system, where the counties have a lot more money in the system than we do, that's partly just a matter of how they adjust which money is ours and which money is theirs, and it can be an accounting matter as much. Other areas, it may be a little bit tighter, and for smaller counties, it may be a little bit harder for them to maneuver and figure out which dollars they put where to be able to do what they think are priorities. But again, the point is, in part, for us, with our money, to say what we think the priority should be.
I appreciate that, and sometimes those opinions vary, and there are local needs that diverge. So. Anybody else on this one? And this is the first I've heard about this. It's interesting. I just remembered the program. Let's keep moving on. We're going to stop at 2:30, and we're going to come back to this on the 24th of February, so you can mark your calendar. It's good to have you here, I guess. You know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm actually transitioning now into the pages that are more about creating savings and addressing the state general fund deficit. So that's the path we'll be taking for the next 5 minutes here and then on the 24th. The first page here on page 44 of your book, I'm sorry, is this the right one? Yes, page 44 of your book. This is a proposal to recover a payment we made to the counties in 2008 and bring it back to the state. In 2007 in the legislature, we were all very concerned about federal regulations around poverty case management. This was a funding stream that counties used to fund services, particularly in the child welfare and the mental health area. And the federal government was moving toward issuing regulations which would have anywhere from wiped out to greatly restricted the ability to use TCM. As a result, the legislature appropriated $32.7 million in one-time money to fund, to help the counties sort of offset what was expected loss of federal revenue. The language said the Department of Human Services, with that $32.7 million, had to allocate the money to the counties when the federal government issued the regulations, and if we determined the effect was going to be $32.7 million or more. That happened. We granted the money out to the counties for the legislation. A few weeks later, Congress came in and put a moratorium on those regulations, meaning the regulations actually never took effect. As a result, since the time that we did this, the counties have had the money that we gave them, which we have no authority to take back under current law, and they also have been able to continue to collect the SSP under the targeted case management. The moratorium on the regulations ends April 1st of this year, except I believe the stimulus bill is going to extend it, and I don't know what the final stimulus bill did in terms of how long or if it extended it. So that is one piece of unknown here. The proposal here is to collect the money back from the counties since they were able to continue to get their SSP through targeted case management. We propose to collect it back in two pieces to help them with cash flow, once in 2010 and once in 2011.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Do the counties
have the foresight to not spend the money?
Mr.
Or is the money already spent?
Representative Haas, there may be 87 answers to that question. I'm not sure. We did talk with counties after the moratorium came along and said, you know, you better watch because this may well be something where we're going to be in a position to be coming back and looking for it. I know we warned counties that we may be taking this direction. I can't speak exactly what counties did with the dollars.
That's for another person.
Oh,
thank you.
Do you have an update on if this moratorium is continuing in the stimulus package? You just came to that meeting. Or did they tell you about that?
Mr. Chair, we don't have all the numbers yet, but in terms of Health and Human Services on Medicaid, looks like it's someplace between $1.7 and $1.9 billion, because the federal match is going to be, I think, what, 6.3?
Oh,
66.3. In addition of 6.3%. Oh. And so that means instead of getting 50%, we'll get 56.3, and in effect, that's a 12% increase.
Yeah.
So the question is, what are the strings? We cannot decrease eligibility from what we had in 2008, but we can change the benefit package. So we could still eliminate chiropractic.
There's always hope, you know.
But, I think this division is going to have a lot of work to do. And Commissioner Hansen was there, and his intent is to try to, we were talking to people from NCSL on a video thing, and nobody's got all the details yet, because it really has not been released. But Commissioner Hansen is going to try to incorporate this into the new budget. I mean, they're going to come out with the forecast on March 3rd, and they may have their budget ready, but they're going to try to include the stimulus package in that their next budget, and which means that Mr. Hansen will be getting a lot of sleep for the next 2 weeks.
No. Well, very good. We're out of time, and do you want to ask some more questions?
Just one real quick.
You have the last word.
Oh, I don't know if I can take that responsibility, Representative Abel. But I just had a question on this page we were just discussing, page 44. Are you? Is there a cost of collection for getting this money back from the county?
The software.
Yeah. How much software do we have to modify to get this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lieberman, we do a lot of back and forth transactions with the counties and settle ups and so forth, so this capacity is built into the existing process. There's no administrative cost to it.
Thank you. We'll see you again, and unless there's any more questions, which I'm not going to take, we're adjourned.
This is a joint hearing with the Healthcare and Human Services Finance and Policy Committees, as well as the Public Safety Finance and Public Safety Policy Committee. We have an extremely important issue, members, and we don't have a lot of time because we're supposed to be back in session at 7:30. We'll try to get done here at 7:30 so we can get over to the floor. And to the testifiers, we apologize for eating our dinner while we're listening to you testify. So we're going to get right into the process here. We've asked representatives from the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services to talk about our sex offender program in both of those institutions, what we're currently doing, and where we're going from here, given the extraordinary cost and also the public safety issues surrounding sex offenders in this state. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to who's going to present first. Is this William Donne?
Bill Donne is my name. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I work for the Department of Corrections. My job is Director of the Risk Assessment Community Notification Unit. What I'm here tonight is to talk about three things that our unit does in the Department of Corrections, and I'll make it abbreviated somewhat from the slides, so I'll be going through some of these slides fairly quickly. The three things I'm talking about is civil commitment screening. And by civil commitment, I mean for sexual psychopathic personality or sexually dangerous person. And then the process that we assign risk levels in the Department of Corrections for community notification purposes, and then briefly a little bit about community notification, how we do that in Minnesota. But before I go into those details, I just want to just give you sort of a broad idea of when we talk about the management of convicted sex offenders in Minnesota. In Minnesota, as many of you are aware, we've been building a system, a protective wall against convicted sex offenders for many years. Since about 1992, there's been a lot of changes to our management system, including the collection of DNA, the registration system, civil commitment, community notification, enhanced sex offender supervision, and very much enhanced sex offender sentencing. I bring that up because that is the system that has been built in Minnesota, and it seems to be working pretty well. And I draw that conclusion based upon the information provided here. This is a graph of three-year recidivism in Minnesota, sexual recidivism. In other words, it demonstrates the rate of sexual recidivism after 3 years of release, starting with those released in 1990. And you'll see that in 1990, those were released 3 years later. They were rearrested for a sex offense at the rate of about 20%. In the year 2002, those released were rearrested at the rate of about 4% for a sex offense. Again, it just demonstrates that we're doing something correct in Minnesota. The system seems to be working. And so I think that's great news, and I think it's a credit to a lot of people in Minnesota, from the legislature to the administration to local law enforcement to corrections to BCA, Department of Human Services. But I also bring it up to keep it in mind that when we're talking about civil commitments and risk level assignments and notifications, they're really small parts of a large system. And I think that's enough said at that. Just sort of good news. When you're talking about the system, prison is part of that system, and there's a releasing process for when offenders are being released from prison. That releasing process is the civil commitment screening, and we'll start with the civil commitment screening. It starts at intake by we assign categories of risk to offenders when they come in and when they're admitted at St. Cloud. Civil commitment screening begins about 12 months before release. We assign risk levels about 3 to 4 months before release, and we try to do community notification at the time of release whenever possible. Sometimes it's not possible. When we talk about risk level assignment and civil commitment, sometimes it's important to recognize that these are two very different processes. They're based upon two different statutes, and the functions are different. In terms of civil commitment, we're looking for the cases that meet the definition of a sexually dangerous person primarily. And that definition is in Minnesota 253D. And it primarily includes three elements that we're looking for a case to be identified as a sexually dangerous person. One of those elements is there has to be a course of harmful sexual conduct. Another element, there has to be a diagnosis that's related to the harmful sexual behavior. And then there has to be a likelihood that the offender is going to engage in harmful sexual conduct again. Those are the three things we're looking for in the civil commitment screening. When it comes to assigning risk levels, we're looking at this case through a different lens. We're looking at this case, according to statute, to do two things. Is to identify the scope and content of community notification. And we do that by assigning risk levels 1, 2, or 3.
Mr. Donne?
Yes.
Can you just hold on 1 second? Representative Cornish has a question.
Mr. Chairman, I'm troubled by the term harmful sexual conduct. There's only one type of sexual conduct, or this conduct I know of, and that's harmful. How do you describe the harmful versus non-harmful? What's that about?
Mr. Donne?
We try to define as many terms as possible, and I have a definition on the slide for harmful sexual conduct. I'll get to it in a bit, but essentially it brings up a good point, is that The whole process is based upon statutory language that it needs considerable interpretation and definition, and that's what we do in the department. And and we've devised policies and procedures based upon the statute and based upon independent legal counsel who assisted us in developing the procedures. That legal counsel happened to be a retired judge who was the presiding judge on the Linehan case. So we've got considerable thought and effort put into our policies, and I'll go more into some of those definitions that we use in our screening process. It's important to remember when we're talking about what we in the department do is we are following Minnesota Statute 244.05, Subdivision 7. And that directs us to do a screen and to identify those offenders who may be appropriate for a petition for civil commitment. Emphasize may be appropriate. And if may be appropriate, we forward that case to the county attorney for the county attorney to take a look at the case to determine whether or not they think they can prove a petition. If so, then they file a petition. And then, of course, the court makes the final determination whether or not to commit. And so what I point that out is because the DOC's process is a screening process. When we forward a case to the county attorney, we're not making a recommendation for commitment. We're following the statute which says we're identifying cases that may be appropriate for the county attorney to file a petition.
Mr. Donahue, if you could hold on for 1 second. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Didn't that recently change? It used to be that the Department of Corrections would only recommend certain people to go, and isn't it the case that now pretty much everyone gets sent on for review by the county attorney's office?
Mr. Donahue.
Chair, members, we have a multi-layered process of screening. The first level is where the committee takes a look at the cases and makes a determination whether or not they want a report from a psychologist. That first level review, in 2008, there was approximately 980 files were reviewed. Out of those 980 files, 151 were forwarded to the county. I think that addresses the question you asked.
Just go on, thank you.
The second level review then is the committee will take a look at that file and they will determine whether or not they want to report. If they want to report, the psychologist from my unit will do a file review, go out, interview the offender, produce a report, and then the committee will take a look at that report. The committee then will make a recommendation to the commissioner whether or not they are recommending for that offender to be forwarded to the county attorney. It's at that point that also independent legal counsel will take a look at that report from the psychologist, and he or she will make a recommendation to the commissioner as well. The independent legal counsel is required by statute to be involved in the process. So if either one of those parties makes a recommendation to refer the case to the county attorney, the case will be referred to the county attorney. If neither of those cases make a recommendation that the case be referred to the county, the case would not be referred to the county, except for one exception, and that is if at some point at later when the risk level is assigned, the offender is assigned a risk level 3, then the case will come back and for another take a look at the civil commitment screening question. And again, if neither the committee nor the legal counsel recommends referral, the commissioner will take a look at that case personally, and the commissioner will make a determination at that point whether or not to refer the case. That's a summary of the screening process. This is a report on the number of cases that have been referred since 1991. And as you can see, that in 2003, the number of cases spiked dramatically. That is in response to the horrific tragedy of the Drew Sedin crime. Since then, we've been referring somewhere around 150, 160 average per year. The question then occurs, what happens to those cases after they go to the county attorney? We try to collect that information in our unit, and taking a look at the cases that we referred in the calendar year 2005, as I said, there was 145 cases referred. This data is as of the end of 2007. So, and what we're looking at here is approximately
40% of those cases referred had been submitted by the end of 2007. And about 40%, the decision had been made not to commit, either at the county attorney level or at the court level. About 20% at that time were still pending, at some stage of pending, yes. So that's the 2005 referrals. The 2006 referrals, again, this is the same currency date, 12/31/07. And that population, at that time, about 22% had been committed, and about 44% of the decision had been made not to permit. And it makes sense, then, about 35% were still pending. We're now in the process of updating this data again, and I expect to see the 2005 population will be around 50% committed, and the 2006 population will be pushing towards 40-45%.
Representative Hilster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm correct, I believe that there's supposed to be referral about a year before they get out, but to the county attorney, but that doesn't always happen. And then there's a movement to hold these folks while it's pending. Is that correct? And then is it the county that picks up the cost of those holding of those prisoners?
You're correct that we are required to refer the case at 12 months prior to release. And we do that in every case where the offender comes to us with a year or more to serve. There are many cases that we don't get them with that much time to serve. For a variety of reasons, they're admitted with less than a year to serve. When that happens, obviously the case is referred with less than 12 months to serve. There has been recent legislation regarding the whole process, and there is a provision that if the offender reaches his release date and he voluntarily requests to stay in DOC rather than DHS, that option is available to him or her for up to 210 days. In response to your question as to who pays, I think I'm going to pass on that to DHS folks here who will probably be more able to answer that accurately.
Thank you.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to find out what percentage, you gave us percentages like 40% committed of the actual civil commitment referrals. What percentage of the people that were due to get out for sex crimes were sent to civil commitment referrals?
Mr. Donahue, do you have that number?
Mr. Chair, member, as I mentioned before, in 2008, the screening committee reviewed 980 files. We referred 151, assuming about 50% of those will get submitted. That gives you an idea of the scope. Thank you.
Okay, please go on.
I'm going to go fairly quickly through the next few slides here, but one of them has to do with the definitions that a member had a question about earlier. And here's the definition we use, the harmful sexual conduct. And this comes, my memory doesn't serve me where this comes from, if it's from statute or from case law, but it creates a substantial likelihood of serious physical or emotional harm to another. In purposes of our screening, a course of harmful sexual conduct obviously includes a conviction, but it also includes other situations. It may include allegations, self-reports, or prison discipline. The incidents don't need to be similar in nature. We consider juvenile behavior in determining whether or not there's a course of harmful sexual conduct. The behavior does not need to be recent. In terms of the diagnosis, as I mentioned, the statutory requirements are for a course. There has to be a course, there has to be a diagnosis, and it has to be highly likely. In terms of a diagnosis, the most common ones we see that are used for the purposes of determining whether or not to refer to the county attorney is things such as sexual sadism, paraphilia, pedophilia, personality disorder, and those sorts of things that are identified here. Other diagnoses can be used if it appears as though there's a fairly strong link between the diagnoses and the sexual harmful behavior. Highly likely, I'm going to go through this quickly. The statute says likely. The case law has indicated that that means highly likely, or it's necessary to view it in terms of highly likely. The important one here that we rely upon a lot is the statistical probability, and we take a look at that through actuarial. And for the screening process, we use three actuarials for each case. And an actuarial is an instrument developed out of research based upon empirical data, and what it does is it identifies characteristics in a sex offender population that are correlated with sex offending. And then we identify those characteristics in the subject individual, and that assists us in determining the likelihood of reoffending. What it does for us is it gives us a score, a cutoff point. And for the purposes of our civil commitment screening, if any one of those actuarial scores high, and the offender meets the other two requirements of the statute, in other words, the diagnosis and the course, he will be referred to the county attorney. In those cases where none of the actuarials score high, but they're scoring moderate or low, the case is reviewed for idiosyncratic features that might indicate a need to refer the case to the county attorney for a further look. Some of the idiosyncratic factors are severe violence, extraordinary harm in the offense, evidence of sexual deviancy. For instance, we might have one sex offense conviction, but it's pretty clear from what went on in that offense that the guy is obsessed or compulsive about sexual harmful behavior. You may have one sex offense, but by description of the offense, there's extreme harm to the victim or severe violence in the crime, maybe some sadomasochism, that sort of thing. Those kinds of things, although they may not technically meet the criteria for civil commitment, it meets our criteria for the screening process to send it on to the county attorney for them to take a look at it to see whether or not they can prove a case up or not.
Can I just ask you about the screening process? Because some psychologists are actually doing the screening. Is that correct?
No, Mr. Chair, it's a committee of three individuals. One of them is a psychologist. One is an administrator from the prison, who's had a lot of involvement in sex offender treatment. And another is from our field services director, who's had a lot of experience with supervising sex offenders in the community.
And how would you assess the assessment in terms of accuracy?
Mr. Chair, there's really no way to determine in terms of whether or not the categorization of high risk or not is valid in the community, because those who 50% of those who are referred get committed, and they never reach the streets. And so, in order to the recidivism rate is not reliable or it's not valid, because they've never had an opportunity to reoffend. In terms of the accuracy of the screening process, I take a look at again. Our statutory function is to identify those who may be appropriate. Of those that we identify and refer, over half of them the county attorneys file a petition on. So my conclusion is our screening process is fairly accurate, because more than half of those that we send, a petition is filed on.
Very good. Please continue.
Just a brief note on release violators. As you all know, when offenders are released from prison, they are placed on supervised release, and they have conditions of release that they have to follow. If they don't follow those conditions of release, they are subject to return to incarceration. This is just for your information, is when they come back to prison, we take another look at them in our unit to determine whether or not that release behavior warrants another look regarding in the terms of the civil commitment screening process. A broader picture of sex offenders in Minnesota, and moving on now out of civil commitment into risk level assignment. This gives you an idea of the total picture of sex offenders in Minnesota. This comes from Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. As you may know, they operate the registration database for Minnesota and do a very good job at it, as I might mention. this is data from January of 2009. At that time, there was a little over 21,000 registered offenders in their database. Approximately 15,000 of those were active registrants. The others have either completed registration, they've moved to another state, they've died, or some reason they've been removed from the database. In terms of how many of those are compliant with the registration laws, BCA reports 94% are compliant. Now, the question is, of those 21,000 offenders, how many get risk levels? And who gets the risk level in Minnesota? Those who are required to register and they're being released from prison, or they're being transferred to Minnesota under the interstate compact, or they're federal offenders who have indicated they're going to reside in Minnesota, or offenders who move to Minnesota who are not under supervision and law enforcement, local law enforcement request that we assign a risk level to them. Those are the people who get a risk level in Minnesota. Risk levels, just briefly, what risk levels do is they define the scope and content of a community notification. Risk level one is the lower risk, and local law enforcement is given the authority by statute to do community notification. The corrections gives them the information. Law enforcement does community notification. Level one, they have the authority to share that information with other law enforcement agencies as well as victim of the offense and witnesses to the offense. Level two is a moderate risk, and in those cases, law enforcement has the authority to notify organizations that primarily serve people who are likely to be victimized. In other words, if the offender has a history of pedophilic behavior, the law enforcement has the authority to notify schools, daycares, and that sort of thing of the neighborhood where the offender is residing. And of course, level three is a higher risk, and that's where law enforcement has the option of doing a broad community notification, oftentimes a level three meeting, or other times just the use of media. Number of risk levels. In 2008, we assigned 814 risk levels, about 13% risk level three, 30% level two, and 57% level one. You can see a significant portion of those are release violators. Since 1996, we've assigned a little over 7,500 risk levels. That gives you an idea. Of the 15,000 active registrants in Minnesota, about 7,500 have risk levels. Recidivism data. This is a study we did in 2007. We took a look at all of those offenders of release with risk levels. And as of January of 2006, what was their reoffense rate, sexual reoffense? As you can see, it's an interesting graph, is the level 1s and the level 2s had reoffended at the same rate. The level 3s and level 1s had reoffended at the same rate. The level 2s had reoffended at a little higher rate. Some people might say that goes to the chairman's question about the accuracy of our risk assessment system. I think it goes to the efficiency of sex offender risk management in Minnesota. What this demonstrates is when an offender is identified as a level three, the system responds with very close supervision, enhanced treatment, polygraph, and a lot of measures are taken to monitor and manage that offender's risk. And I think this reflects that it's fairly effective in terms of the reoffense risk rate. Obviously, any reoffense is too many, again, this is a demonstration that the systems that have been set up seem to be having a positive impact on recidivism in Minnesota.
Representative Hilston has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So why do you think that a level two is actually higher?
Mr. John.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilston. Level two is whatever the fact elements are that brought that risk level designation to the level two are the risk factors that are being dealt with. When they are released, it would be my contention that if they got the same amount of supervision and same amount of scrutiny as the level threes did, those that reoffense rate would be lower as well. What we have done is one of our concerns is you might take a look at this chart and say, well, then they all should be level three. And our concern is if we do that, we will dilute the consequences or the effects of a level three.
Now, this is what I'm saying. If we make them all threes, none of them will be threes. So what we're trying to do is take a look at some alternative types of releasing procedures and programming for these level twos to see if we can bring that reoffense rate down as well.
Representative Levy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to kind of note here out loud that these are people who were released from 97 to 2002. So this predates our current civil commitment, or we were obviously doing civil commitment, but this predates the sort of the current method that we have where we're, you know, locking up large numbers of offenders and basically never letting them out, right? So these are presumably in the people that are in this graph are many who would now be in locked up in civil commitment, correct?
Mr. Dye.
Mr. Chair, member. First, I need to correct that slide. That's 1,763 offenders were released. But civil commitment began in 1991, but you are correct. It is the numbers that have been committed following 2003 are higher than that period of time. Many of these offenders may have been release violators. Some of these offenders have gone through the civil commitment screening process post-2003, but not all of them, true. I understand the nature of your question, and I'm not. I would have to do some analysis to come up with a specific answer to that. But it's you're right. A lot of these offenders went through this process prior to 2003.
Representative Levy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, it kind of goes back to Representative Tamar's question about, you know, do we have any way of evaluating how well we're doing at identifying the people who are truly the highest risk of reoffense and isolating those and getting those into the civil commitment process as opposed to just erring way on the side of caution and putting in a lot of people at very large cost who perhaps don't really need to be there. And this graph seems to me the best indication we've got so far that we may indeed be doing that, because these are, you know, I mean, any reoffense is a bad thing, no question about it, and some are very, very bad, but these are pretty low numbers, it seems to me, and it's kind of almost a, I mean, it's not an, it's sort of a natural experiment in a way.
Mr. Donahue, remember, one thing that's important to remember here is these, I wouldn't have been correct. My thought was not correct.
Mr. Donahue, can I ask this, maybe a follow-up question to Representative Liebling was asking this. If I understand the statistics correctly, in 2003, pre-Rodriguez, there were about 15 offenders who were committed, civilly committed a year, and today there's about 50 a year. So are we seeing a decline then in sexual offenses based on that those numbers, or are we not keeping that kind of research?
Mr. Chair, we're seeing a decline in sexual reoffending. In terms of sex offending in Minnesota, I'm not able to respond. I don't know.
But reoffenses, you're saying.
I think it's another thing to, if you take a look at the statutory language in 253B that defines sexually dangerous person, you can see some of the reasons for the number of referrals is the language is fairly broad. And we didn't go through all of the factors here, and I know there are some attorneys in the room here who would be very adept at talking about this civil commitment process in depth in terms of the statutory factors and how they're interpreted in the court of law. But from my experience as a screener, which is basically, you know, not the legally sophisticated perspective, but if you take up those three elements in the statute, of course, of harmful sexual conduct, what is the definition of that? And you take a look at the diagnosis, the statutory language for diagnosis, and it's very broad and open to lots of a different interpretation. Then you take a look at highly likely to commit to engage in harmful sexual conduct in the future. What does likely mean? What does harmful sexual conduct mean? And so, you know, if the concern is the number of referrals and the number of commitments, one place, you know, the statutory language is the funnel. And when we're doing the screening process, it's a fairly big funnel. And if the number of commitments is, if it seems worthwhile to take a look at reducing the number of commitments, some changes to the statutory language may achieve what you hope to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Haas.
Thank you very much. Just maybe a comment. You know, when you think about some of these sexual offenders, they have a lifetime of offenses. And then somebody maybe later, after 40 years, brings up a case where they were actually abused. And then there's a flood of victims that come forward. But they only have one of, you know, they have that arrested once. And now we get out and we have them wandering around and we say, here's a real offense. Is there any way of determining if there's a flood of these things before we have the second real offense? In other words, is that a pretty accurate relationship between real offending and offending? Or is it just perchance we've caught them now again with a sea of criminal offenses that they haven't been charged with?
Mr. Donner.
Mr. Chair, member, there's quite a bit of literature that talks about the number of offenses that an offender has done prior to getting caught. And it ranges a broad range from anywhere from 5 to, and depending on how you define a sexual offense, up to 70 or 80. I think I don't have any data to support this, but I would say after an intervention, after an incarceration, after a treatment, and after he's placed on supervision in Minnesota, it's very unlikely that you're going to see that number of offenses before he gets apprehended again. Because you have an agent, you have law enforcement who knows about him, you have treatment people who knows about him, and the likelihood that you're going to see that sort of flagrant offending, in my opinion, is very low. It's just not possible. It's very unlikely that somebody who's under supervised release in Minnesota is going to be able to get by with reoffending for very long. Not to say it doesn't happen.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Haas, just to follow up. When some of the sexual offenders in the county level are on probation for a while, they were being able to use lie detectors to determine activity. Is that still legitimate, and are they still doing that?
Mr. Donner.
Mr. Chairman, yes, they are still doing that. Polygraph is a significant part of the treatment programs across Minnesota.
I think we'll have to have Representative Hillstrom. Oh, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Justin.
Representative Hayden, then Hillstrom, and then I think we need to bring this to a close because we want to hear from Dennis Denson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick demographic question. Is there any breakdown of the demographics by race or even gender? You usually say it's men. Are there any women in the sexual offender program?
Mr. Donner.
Mr. Chair, member, I don't have offhand the race. We definitely have the data on the racial composition of sex offenders. In terms of females, yes, there are female sex offenders. I don't know today how many are at the Shakopee facility, but we do assign risk levels to female sex offenders, and we do screen them for civil commitment. It's a very low number compared to the males, but there are some females.
Could you get that information,
Mr. Chairman?
Could you get that information to me or to the committee? I just think it's just in the discussion. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me, is everyone that is evaluated at the beginning of intake who's been told that they need sex offender treatment, do they get sex offender treatment while they're incarcerated, or is there a waiting list or treatment?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I was just looking for an opportunity to turn this over to Steve Allen, and I think you just gave me the great gave it to me.
Mr. Allen, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Allen. I'm the Director of Behavioral Health Services with the Minnesota Department of Corrections. There are approximately 1,600 sex offenders, adult males, in our system who are directed to sex offender treatment at any given point. We are able to treat about 20% of those who are directed to treatment prior to their release to the community. For those who do not receive treatment while incarcerated, these folks are directed to do community programs after their release.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you have any correlation between those who got treatment while they're incarcerated and those who do not, based on who comes back and who then gets civilly committed?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, are you asking, is the civil commitment rate different for offenders who have received treatment while in the corrections or in the community versus those who have not?
That is correct.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, we recently took a look at that over a two-year period using 2004 to 2005 data. During those years, about 315 offenders were released or were referred, forwarded to the counties for review for civil commitment. Of that group, approximately half, or 50.5%, did not receive treatment during their incarceration with us. 47% of those were civilly committed. The other half who did receive treatment were also civilly committed at a rate of 47%. For that sample, there was no difference between civil commitment and having succeeded in treatment and those who were not offered an opportunity for treatment.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for your testimony. We're going to have you back. This is there's far too many questions that I think at least the public safety committees want to have answers to. But thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Benson? I thought we were going to have an hour and a half meeting here, and we only have an hour. And you know we're going to start right on time. Mr. Benson, welcome to the committee. Missed you at the other side.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. My name is Dennis Benson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Programs in Minnesota. We've got about 17 slides here. We're going to move through very quickly. I'm Dennis Benson, the Director, and with me today is Janine Aber, the Executive Clinical Director. I'm going to give you some very brief and quick background on the program, and then Janine is going to speak to you a little bit about what happens once an offender is civilly committed and reaches one of our facilities. Today we have two sites, but we're using three facilities. The St. Peter site, we have about 175 patients down there, and then up at the Moose Lake Hospital site, we have approximately 150. And then as many of you know, in the public safety committees, we're also renting two buildings from the prison facility at Moose Lake that we refer to as the annex. We have approximately 200 patients in the annex. That arrangement hopefully will terminate somewhere around July 1 when our new building opens up. We're opening up a new 400-bed building on or about July 1st. This next slide just gives you the population, both historically. You can see the growth from 2000 and where we're at today. What we're projecting, the growth rate is around 70, 75 a year for 2009 and 10. Goes up a little bit in those out years, but as you know, in dealing with inmate population projections, as you get closer from today, they start to get a little fuzzy. And with this program, we haven't had the same kind of history to base those projections on. So this is based on, as Mr. Storkamp were here, he would say,
today's laws, practices, and something else. I forget the other term, but anyway, as laws change, as practices change, so do projections. A little bit like budget projections. Pretty accurate for a year or two, and then they start to, that's why we do them every year. This next slide, again, is where we're at in terms of beds. The black at the bottom are the beds that we currently have, with the exception of the white bar in 2007 and 8. Those are the annex beds, again, at the prison. When we open phase one of the bonding project, again, that's scheduled to open in July. That's another 400 beds. That's the yellow. And then the blue at the top of the grid would be the phase two of the bonding project, which we haven't bonded yet. But by 2011, we're going to be out of beds at, again, today's rates. So we will be, I'm sure, talking with the executive branch about a bonding proposal next year again in the bonding cycle. And then this next slide is the cost. I know there's a lot of interest in cost, rightfully so. It's an expensive program. In fiscal year 8, the cost was $368 a day. That was the stated per diem. This year, we brought it down a little bit to $348. When we bring the new 400-bed facility on in July, we believe it's going to be $315 a day. And, of course, when we fill that up, it's a very efficient building. We think we can get it down to $285 a day. Ultimately, when the second 400-bed facility is filled up again, we start to realize more economy of scale. We think we can get that per diem down to around $250 a day. That's in today's dollars without inflation. If you look at the states below, these are some comparisons again, as is the case with correctional per diems. Not everybody figures it the same way. I can tell you that the per diem that MSOP states includes everything. It is statutorily driven and includes everything from a piece for bonding to central office costs, etc.
Mr. Benson, we have a question. If there was.
Just real quick, Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Benson, can you just tell me if the full-time FTEs will remain the same as you go through the progression of the per diem?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we continue to work with the staffing numbers in our facilities. I can tell you that we're running these two facilities today with 150 fewer staff today than we were a year ago. We have realized some efficiencies in a variety of different ways. We think that once we get into this new building, there may be more efficiencies. I can also tell you that aside from some cooks, MSOP has not laid anybody off. We've done this, accomplished this through attrition. Included in that number are 28 supervisors, middle managers, and a couple of managers. So we did have one manager layoff. So we are working with this new population. It's a new experience for me. My history is 34 years in corrections, but the one thing we did understand over there was how to staff these facilities. So we continue to try to staff them as efficiently as we possibly can.
Representative Haas.
Thank you very much. Help just educate me or clarify for my memory. What would be the cost of this individual in the prison versus in the civil hold in the...
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, I believe the DOC per diem is somewhere between $80 and $85 a day today. So it's significantly cheaper. There are challenges that we have that are unique to our population. This is a patient population, not an offender population. They have their civil rights restored. We can't lock them down the way that we can lock down a prison population. We have a fair amount of oversight in this program, Department of Health, Department of Human Services. There are licensing issues that we have to abide by. again, those that provide any level of vocational work, we're required to pay them prevailing or minimum wage. We have to provide treatment to anybody who wants treatment. So we have lots of clinical staff. We have to treat 100% if they want treatment. That's why they're there. That's kind of the thrust of the program. The purpose of the program is to treat them. We also, included in this population, have a few vulnerable adults that drive the cost. Historically, this program has not utilized multiple cell occupancy to the same degree that the prison system does, for all the obvious reasons. We have three sites in for just 505 patients, which also adds some inefficiency. And again, as we get into these new 400-bed units, I think those costs can come down a little, but as you can see from on this slide, it's not unusual to pay $200, $300, $400, or $500 a day for this population. Again, a strong treatment component. I believe we have about 75 clinical staff, and our costs are spread out over 500 patients as opposed to almost 10,000 offenders. So we don't realize that same economy of scale that corrections does either. Highly litigious crowd as well, challenging the constitutionality of the program and the way that we run it.
Representative Hodge, are you done?
I would like just one follow-up. So when we go from 80 to 300 and whatever, because we increase the treatment, is that treatment working? Is anybody being released that's receiving this treatment?
Mr. Benson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Haas, that's a good and fair question. The reality is we have not released anybody in 12 years from this program. I think that some of that will become more understandable when you hear Janine's testimony here in a moment. I would also say that out of the 18,000 registered sex offenders, remember now, the 500 that end up in our program have fallen through several different layers of different systems. They are certainly a challenging group. Some of them choose not to participate in treatment. They're probably not going to be released anytime soon. Treatment for this kind of patient is very long term. Again, Janine can talk about that. I will tell you this, though, that we do have somebody that is outside of our secure perimeter in the community preparation program. That occurred within the last year. We've got a couple more that are in the pipeline. We have a strong clinical component to the program now, hiring new clinical staff in the last several months. We believe that we are practicing the best treatment that's out there. I'd also say that we're not the only program that hasn't released anybody in recent years. We pay attention to the other programs out there. We're learning some things, and hopefully our obligation is to provide the best treatment we can. The courts decide who comes in. The courts also decide when somebody is ready to be released.
Members, just want to remind you, we do have session, and I've asked Ms. McMahon to check to find out if we're actually starting on time. So if we can, you know, I would prefer that we have an opportunity to ask as many questions as possible. So Representative Kittmeyer, and then Olin and Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it's good to see you again, having gone through this presentation a while. One of the things I did note, though, in the question that you had, Representative Liebling, in these recidivism rates and some of these statistics, it appears as though there's a somewhat of a correlation between the fact that we increase civil commitment and then we're showing a reduction in recidivism, basically saying it's not that they've really less predisposed to going back to their habits of the past. They just have the opportunity because they're in civil commitment. Is that a fair approach, or...
Mr. Benson?
Mr. Chair and Representative, obviously those people that end up going
going from prison to our program certainly don't have the opportunity to reoffend. I don't know how that squares with the statistics that corrections presented.
Representative Ola.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is a philosophical question. It'll take a longer time to put together than we will in this session. And Mr. Benson, you've been working on the reason I'm asking you is you've been working on both the prison population and in St. Peter now. And the question is, would there possibly be a situation, or is it just as likely that we would have more luck if we were to go to the indeterminate sentencing method on the very serious offenders? Because we're sending, a lot of these guys are never going to cooperate with treatment anyway, so we could just as well be doing it a different way. Instead of a sentencing guideline saying, the guy's up to date.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe we are doing some of that. There is some indeterminate sentencing options available to the courts with respect to some of the high-risk or high-end sex offenders. So, again, that's, I think, really a policy decision that needs to be made.
Quick follow-up. But it is safe to say that we are missing, in a lot of cases, people that probably should have had a different sentencing level in the first place because we're wasting money by sending them to this program. I've got one of these 20-plus ones that I put there many years ago. So I, as a prosecutor, am just throwing that thought out there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Benson, I see that we have the difference in prices for different states. Have you also compared the rate of civil commitment in other states compared to the rate of civil commitment in Minnesota? And if not, could you get that for us at a later date?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, yes, we can do the best we can. I believe there are around 20 programs, 19 programs, I believe, out there. Currently, we can see what we can get. That's a work in progress. It changes all the time in terms of how many people are committing. I can tell you that Wisconsin, which is a program that we pay some attention to, there are some similarities in the law. They're a little bit less than us, but not a lot. I think it's around 80 to 100 fewer civil commits than we have. So we do have a large program. We're very close to California, for example, which is the largest program, I believe, right now. So we have a wide net, but we pay very close attention to this offender group in Minnesota, as we all know, for all the obvious reasons. Again, with respect to sentencing, I think that's a work in progress. Those options are available to you. The law is the law today, and we're required to follow it, and we're doing the very best we can with a challenging population.
Mr. Benson, just for the sake of time here, I'm just wondering if you want to talk about the changes in the program and how what the process is now for evaluating who will potentially get out. That's sort of the big policy question that we have to grapple with, and I don't know if that would... if you'll be skipping too much of your presentation, but...
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Janine to start into her slides because she gets at some of that.
Could you please introduce yourself for the record?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I'm Janine Aver. I'm the Executive Clinical Director of NSOP. I can talk fast and I can go through the slides as quickly as possible.
Okay.
Members, the first slide here is a bit of a context, and Representative had asked earlier about the percentage of reported offenses versus those that are convicted. And just for a bit of context, when we talk about the incidents of sexual abuse, only a portion of those are reported, a portion of those are investigated, a portion of those are substantiated, a portion of those are charged and then convicted. So we really are talking about what hits the light of day for us. Some studies indicate that 88% of child sexual abuse cases go unreported, and about 1 in 6 victims of any sexual abuse will report. And just because, of course, something's reported doesn't mean that it ends up in a full conviction. So when we think about this, the vast majority of Minnesota of registered sex offenders do reside on probation. A small piece go to prison, and the piece that come to us are the small, about 2% of registered sex offenders. So while some may call that the worst of the worst, we do have a highly clinically complex and challenging population, and it's a small proportion of who they are. This next slide goes briefly through the civil commitment process for many of you who are familiar with it. As Bill Danae spoke earlier, the cases are referred to the county of commitment. If someone is up to their SRD and DOC, they do have the option now to stay 210 days in corrections, or they're transferred down to St. Peter, which is our reception facility, and we process the admits there, or we keep them on hold until the initial commitment. 60 days after that is what we call the report to court, where we see if they still meet the criteria for commitment. And surprisingly, they all have been civilly committed to final commitment, at which point then they enter our treatment program or are provided the opportunity for treatment. Once someone is finally committed, every 6 months they have the option to petition to the Special Review Board and then on to SCAP for a decrease in custody level or provisional discharge or full discharge. They also, in order to go to the Community Preparation Services, which is the program outside of the wire, outside of the secure perimeter, that also has to go through SRB and SCAP. So the way that we talk about it is that the courts put folks in and the courts determine who is released at what level, whether it be through outside the secure perimeter or provisional discharge or full discharge. As treatment providers, we let somebody know where they're at in treatment and the progress they've made in treatment, but the court ultimately makes that determination. This is the step-down process of MSOP. So as I said, someone comes into admissions at St. Peter. Once that process is complete and the courts have determined they are finally committed, they go up to Moose Lake for primary treatment. Should they progress through primary treatment, they then go back to St. Peter, which is what houses our transitional and reintegration services. They go through SRB and SCAP. If they go on to community preparation services, provisional discharge, and then final full discharge. So risk needs responsivity is a model that we borrowed from the criminology. It's been around since the late 70s, but it's taken favor now with sex offenders. It's the model that's used across Canada for all offenders and is now used most predominantly with sex offenders around here. DOC also uses the model. Someone is assessed for risk, and we match the level of intervention with their risk. So the higher the risk, the greater intensity of intervention. Treatment effect is important. We know that if someone is low risk and we give too much treatment to them, that we make them worse. And we know through research that if someone is high risk and we, of course, don't do high enough intervention, that we, of course, jeopardize risk later. So it's important to do a good assessment on the front end to determine risk and match the level of intervention with it. After that, we determine the needs, which is, you may have heard the dynamic risk factors or criminogenic needs. I'll show you a slide about what that is. And any assessment or treatment program should be addressing criminogenic needs or forensic evaluation that happens on the front end. And then responsivity is important to any treatment program. And responsivity is about matching the modes or style of treatment with the lenses of the person who's participating, whether it be their cultural difference, their cognitive abilities, how they see the world. And that's sort of what we call the art of treatment. Here's the list of the criminogenic needs. I'm not going to go through them. But these are the dynamic risk factors for sex offenders. You can see in there some of the typologies or subgroups of sex offenders. For instance, the emotional congruence with children would probably be present for most child molesters or pedophiles, but may not be present for someone who we would know as an adult rapist. So that individual may have a higher category around the hostility towards women, for instance. So these are the risk factors that treatment targets. And when someone does risk, this is also similar factors that are used in Department of Corrections to see where someone is at in their process. When you think about treatment, there are different spectrums of symptomology or of issues, and folks fall differently on the continuum.
You know, I have to really apologize for this. We're going to have you back.
Happy to, Mr.
Believe it or not, we're actually starting on time. And so I'm going to adjourn the meeting. We will have you back. I want you to complete your testimony. Thank you very much.